Okay, I'm going to call to order this May 24th, 2016 hearing of the Senate Interim Committee on Workforce. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for coming bright and early. And we're going to get started bright and early. We have a very full agenda today with several really interesting topics. And we're going to start off on a real high note. And that is going to be a report on graduation rates and equity performance for our new Career Technical Education Revitalization Program, which has been in effect now for about a half a dozen years, or close to it, and is showing some really promising results. So to hear about that, I'm going to ask Brian Krieg, Tom Thompson, and Daniel Adams to come up, please. Okay, so what is this career technical ed thing, and what can you tell us, please?
Good morning, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, Brian Krieg. Today I'm here as the co-chair of the Career and Technical Education Grant Revitalization Committee. That's a mouthful. Yes, it's been an interesting adventure for about 6 years now since you first passed some of the legislation to start revitalizing our schools with vocational classes, hands-on training, and a combination of CTE and STEM. The last time we were before you here at the committee, we had announced about the revitalization grants for this two-year cycle that we're in at the moment, and that's the map that is up in front of you. You've seen that before. We were awarded about $9 million in the grants there. The grant program has expanded a little bit, and there's going to be a couple more sections of it that we will briefly talk about here. I'm going to let my my friends here from the Department of Education talk about them, but in those other grants that we have, along with revitalization, we expanded the amount of monies last time. So one of the areas we put in was a pathway set of grants, the next one was some summer program grants, and then a small amount of money for some course equivalency work because of the issue of trying to adapt our science and math classes that we have and the requirements for graduation and how we could work that better with shop classes on that. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Tom Thompson from the Department of Education, and then Daniel will also be then bringing up the section about the equity issues.
Good morning, Senator Dembrough and committee members. My name is Tom Thompson with the Oregon Department of Education. I'm an ed specialist in industrial and engineering systems, and I also work with a number of the CTE grants. And I'd like to just summarize a few of these that we're working on at this point, just give you a couple pieces of information and give them enough time to be able to move on to the graduation rate piece. As Brian mentioned, we are in the process of working through CTE revitalization for this is the third round. We have 25 grants that went out this last year. We've gotten progress reports that are coming in, and really what we're seeing is a promising year as schools implement some of their projects based on the funds they got, and also we can see from the reports that we're getting that we're going to see a trend that's going to be similar to previous years and some very successful projects and growth in that. The CTE revitalization was really designed to really build and build new programs and get things up and running. The next program, go ahead, is on the Secondary Career Pathways funding, which is a brand new funded program. And I think one of the things that would be really interesting to see that the breadth of which with coverage here, you can see the map as far as the number of schools that have benefited from this program, 283 programs, 147 schools, ranging anywhere from $2,000 for a program, not a school necessarily, but a program, to $45,000 for some programs. And you may recall that this is actually sort of an incentive funding based on the number of students that have earned three or more credits and a couple other criteria, including the historically underserved students that are earning three or more credits. That fund has been distributed for 2015-16, and we are preparing for the next round for 2016-17 school year.
And Tom, if I can interrupt you. So the goal here is to provide a foundation for a more stable funding of CTE, right?
Chair Dembrough, that is correct. That's the idea.
As opposed to having to apply for a grant and going through that process.
Yes, that is correct.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair.
While we're sort of paused here, could you define secondary career pathway program just in a sentence or two?
Certainly. Chair Dembro and Senator Thatcher. The career pathway, the term is broadly used in a variety of senses, but in this case what we're talking about is a program of study, which is a sequence of courses that fit within a certain career area, such as manufacturing or construction or health sciences and that type of thing. So students that receive or programs that receive this funding have students that have earned three or more credits in that sequence of classes over the period of the 4 years that they're within that high school.
Thank you. Secondary, just okay. You're talking about like secondary education, not second, like. Anyway, just kind of had it.
Secondary education. I'm sorry. High schools. Right. Yes. Thank you.
We'll be getting to post-secondary in the next panel.
Got it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Then the next piece was really about recruiting and retaining students, trying to bring more students into career and technical education and keeping them involved in career and technical education so they move on into careers. The CT summer programs is really something that we believe will do that. And the summer programs are for middle schools and for high school students. We have 9 sites that are putting together programs, and those programs will be happening this summer and the following summer. We have, for example, stories that Salem Kaiser has a grant that they're working on. They've already filled. In fact, they filled their slots for their summer programs even before they got out to all the schools. And the same thing, Lane ESD with their health occupations did the same. They filled that with 100% of their students that are filled that being in high in the historically underserved populations that we're trying to target for these. And then the final is what Brian talked about, a small program that is really focused on trying to open up the space for students to be able to take more career and technical education courses by providing opportunities for credit in core academic content through career and technical education. We're just beginning the work in that. We have six schools involved in that pilot project. And at this point, we turn it back to Dan. I'll turn it over to Daniel, and he's going to talk about the next piece there.
Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Daniel Adams. I'm the Program Accountability and Data Specialist for the CTE team at ODE, and I get nervous, so I brought some notes. I hope that's okay. Oregon CTE concentrators in the graduating class of 2014 were 15.5 percentage points more likely to graduate high school in 4 years than were students statewide. But this paper's a month or two old, so you probably already knew that. There are 5 places I want to help shine a spotlight today, and just for the sake of clarity, the blue bars represent CTE concentrators, and the gold bars represent the entire student population statewide. So let's start with the gaps between the blue bars and the gold bars. What these gaps tell us is that CTE concentrators graduate at higher rates across every student population we measure. The bigger the gap, the better CTE concentrators do compared to students statewide in the same group. Some of these gaps are very big. Among CTE concentrators, Hispanic Latino students, African American students, and Native American students graduated more than 20 percentage points ahead of the same student population statewide. So let's go to that gray line right across your sheet there. These CTE data are the most recent available. They're for the graduating class of 2014. So that gray bar is the statewide graduation rate for all Oregon students in the class of 2014. It was 72%. The negative gap between the gold bars and the gray line is the achievement gap, with which I'm sure you're already familiar. The negative gap means that across Oregon, some student groups graduate at rates lower than the statewide average of 72%. The positive gap between the blue bars and the gray line indicates that CTE concentrators not only do better than students in the same group statewide, CTE concentrators in every racial ethnic subpopulation we can measure actually graduate above the statewide average of 72%. I call the positive gap between the blue bars and the gray line the CTE achievement gap, and it is positive. My notes reminded me to pause and make eye contact while I turn my page. So I've done this presentation a few times now. My coworkers even let me practice on them yesterday, so thanks, team. About now is when I usually get asked whether the data from 2014 are the exception or the rule. We talked about the most recent 2014 gap being more than 15 percentage points. We also have data for the class of 2013, and that gap was even bigger. In 2013, CTE concentrators were 17 percentage points more likely to graduate in 4 years. Another question I often get is there any research that could help buttress these Oregon data? Yes. A 2013 study of Mississippi students found that CTE students in career pathways graduated 7 percentage points above the statewide average for all students. A more recent 2016 study of Arkansas students found that CTE concentrators are 21 percentage points more likely to graduate from high school. That study also found that CTE concentrators are more likely to be employed, more likely to have higher earnings, and more likely to be enrolled in two-year college than similar non-CTE concentrators. The last question I almost always get is, okay, we can tell that CTE is working, but how is it working? The best evidence available is anecdotal feedback from the field. What we hear from Oregon students is that in CTE classrooms, students rarely ask, when am I ever going to use this? We hear from CTE teachers that classrooms practice applied learning, allowing students to build skills through what the research calls deliberate practice. And we hear from administrators that rather than telling students there's one way to be successful, you have to go to college, CTE classrooms start by asking the student what their dream is and then helping each student work toward that dream. If the student's dream is 2 or 4 year college, there's evidence that CTE programs of study create college ready students. If the student's dream is a rewarding, high wage, high demand career in their hometown, CTE concentrators finish with skills and experience employers say they need. While we wait for the definitive study on how CTE works, we can listen to the voices of students, faculty, and administrators. They tell us that CTE works by helping students build the skills they need to achieve their own dreams.
For Springfield High School junior Leah Crimbo, her elective courses changed her path in high school.
I absolutely hated high school, didn't like the people here, didn't like the classes, didn't want to do my work.
But then she tried the hands-on course for automotive tech, giving her a new outlook.
It just sparked an interest, and now that I have automotive in the mornings, it gives me motivation to get up, go to school, do my work right so I can stay in these classes.
I think we've talked about CTE for quite a few years. We've kind of turned the ship around, and we've put it in motion. And I think today one of the things with some of the statistics that Daniel has brought, it really does hammer home how important it is for many students in the state, and especially some of the more vulnerable populations that we have, the underserved population out there. And that what we saw with, as the Senator Dembro mentioned about the differences of the two main grants, the pathway funding and then the revitalization. We've been revitalizing in the schools, giving them new equipment, getting the teachers trained, getting the shop facilities and other facilities built back up. Then putting the pathway funding gives the monies to start moving ahead so that they're feeling secure that the teachers are going to be there to do this type of work. The thing we saw with the revitalization grants this last round was that some of the schools that are at that 2 credits, not the 3 credit level where they were going to get more money, actually took like a welding shop class in Baker is a great example, the Baker Technical Institute. They had 2 credits for welding there. They expanded the shop, got new equipment, taught the teachers, moved them up so that they would be a 3-credit pathway, a much better one for their population and the kids to be able to graduate and go actually find jobs. They tied the two things together so they would get the future funding. It is exactly the model that we were trying to generate out there, and we're seeing that with quite a few of the applications. And I'll conclude by noting that this week back in Washington, D.C., all the CTE folks are back there talking, and they're releasing a vision statement about how CTE should be done, the types of programs within it, and the types of trainings for the nation on that. And what I can say is everything that we have put into the package so far are key elements that are in that vision plan. So we are right on track and actually maybe leading the pack, though we do need to have further funding and expand this.
Thank you. Questions, comments? Yes, Senator Rosemary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the data is really impressive. My question is, how do we know that there isn't something else going on with this particular group of students that select or get involved in CTE that they might be more motivated just in general?
Chair Dembro and Senator Rosebaum. There are many potential factors, and I don't have the definitive research yet on what causes these results. As I said, the best evidence right now is anecdotal. I'd be happy to continue looking at that for you if that would be helpful.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Gelser.
I think I had the same question, and it goes back to having comprehensive high schools that really focus on that question of what do you want to do, what do you want to be. And I know in our district, our high school graduation rates are very high. We have robust CTE programs, but we also have very robust career learning programs, mentoring programs, after-school tutoring programs. And I wonder how reflective the investment that a community makes, often through a local option levy, in their schools that allows that CTE to be developed and happen also reflects that investment in the school overall for kids to have comprehensive choices. So kind of the same question as Senator Rosenbaum.
Chair Dembrough and Senator Gelser. I think part of that, all of those pieces that you mentioned are really something that is incorporated into CTE. So there are cases, I'm sure, and your area is a good example of where people have taken those principles and spread them throughout the school, and rather than localize them in just a CTE program. So there's all integral pieces of career and technical education, that whole career guidance, that the work with students, the tutoring in many of those programs we see actually coming in. So whether it's actually concentrated in a program or whether it's out there, these are all successful strategies, I believe. But what we are able to see is that those students that are then taking these courses that are in these programs that have these strategies are successful. And that's, I think, the critical piece.
I think just to follow up, I think there are a number of factors that part of it is seeing yourself on a pathway. Part of it is being part of a cohort. There's what I've seen when I visited programs, a really strong sense of identity and friendship and maybe a closer relationship with teachers, actually, or a more long-lasting relationship with teachers as well. It's all of these things. But I think what's really compelling is that, as you suggested, Daniel, what we're experiencing here in Oregon is replicated really all over the country where you have these programs with all different models, but, CTE students generally graduate at a much higher rate. And what's really impressive is to see, how well it's doing with these populations. One question that I do have, though, is how are the numbers in these, for these disadvantaged students? I mean, are we getting such students into programs in large numbers? I mean, it appears that if they are in the programs, they do well, but yeah.
Chair Dembrough, those numbers are provided for you on the front of the packet. So you can see the last column to the right, CTEN. So how many students are we talking about? We can see that for some of these populations, it ranges from 73 students in the graduating class across the state of Oregon all the way to over 10,000 students. So when we're talking about this group of students, we're talking about a graduating class of CTE concentrators of over 14,000 students across the state.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the difference between, the percentage of, let's say, African-American students in our schools and the number that are in CTE programs, I mean, how are we doing?
Chair Demmer, I'd be happy to look into that and provide those numbers.
Because I think there's a story of success here, and if we're not getting students into the programs, they may not realize just what a pathway this is for them, and perhaps we should focus even more. I'm sure there's a lot going on to do that, but perhaps we need to do even more to get students into the programs. Yes, Senator.
Senator Dembrough, and just response to that that same question, just looking at our data from CTE revitalization, and that, and I'm sure we have the same kind of data for the whole CTE programs. At a very minimum, what we have is the same sort of diversity that we have, it represents what's in the schools. Now, that doesn't mean that is the target, that we, any student that could benefit from CTE, if they're not in those programs, we would like to see them in those programs. But at this point, from the data that we can see, at least what we're doing is, at a minimum, being able to match that with the school population, that we're not underserving a particular group based on the school population. We may need to spend more, a greater effort in making sure that every student that deserves that opportunity has that opportunity.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough. Could you remind us of the investment that we've made over the last couple of bienniums in CTE, and then what it would take to roll this out even further into more districts, obviously affecting more kids, because there are very few things that we see. I also serve on the Education Committee with some of my colleagues up here, and there's very few things that we see that make a difference, a measurable difference in graduation rates. And so when we see something that does, we want to do what we can to invest strategically to make a difference. So do you have numbers and a plan for, say, the 17th session?
Chair Dembrough, Senator Knope, if you look back 7 years ago, roughly, the state was putting almost nothing into this. We were solely reliant on federal funds. There was a small amount that the state was putting to it. 6 years ago, we started down the path. We put $2 million. And then the next 2 years later, we put $11 million. And then this last round, there's $22 million for CTE. It was a $35 million package for CTE and STEM together that we had. If you were to look at other, to the north, the state of Washington spends over $400 million a year on biennium up in Washington. The question for us in Oregon, where would we be at? We've looked at numbers in different ways, and at least 200 million is really the kind of target, but that's a much more comprehensive. That would have things like regional schools and other things in it, in a similar model to what they're doing to the north.
Great. So we're going to have to move on, but I promise Daniel and Tom, and probably Brian, will be sending you to Ways and Means at some point, within the year. So it's, I obviously echo Senator Knope's comments. This is something that has been nurtured over the last few years, and, it has demonstrated its value, and it's time to, really move it forward. So thank you. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so I'll close that session on impact of CTE on graduation rates and equity, and now a session on career pathways as we move into the post-secondary world. And I'll call up Dr. Ali McGeehan, Mark Goldberg, Skylar Stearns, and Marginette Ware. Can we get four of you? Yeah. All right, so who's going to tell us what we mean by career pathways and what we're doing with it? Mark, are you starting?
Yes.
Great.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Goldberg. I'm the Associate Vice President for Workforce Development and Community Education at Portland Community College. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak about career pathways at the post-secondary level. And you'll get a chance to hear from my colleagues here, and I'll introduce them now. We've got different perspectives. We have Ali McGeehan, who's the statewide Career Pathways Director for Community Colleges. We have Skylar Stearns, who's a faculty member in Career Pathways and one of our most innovative programs at PCC, the HVAC program. And then Marginette Ware, who's a current PCC student and a former Career Pathways student, or actually a Career Pathways graduate of one of our programs on campus. So with that, I'll let Ali speak at the state level and give more historical background on career pathways.
Thank you. Welcome, Ali.
Chair Dembrough, Senators. I am Allie McGeehan. I am the Statewide Career Pathways Initiative Director. And just to give you a little bit of my history, I've been in this position since March, but I've been involved with Career Pathways for the last 6 years in Oregon as I was at Umpqua Community College as an administrator, and the Career Pathways grant was under my area, and so I'm familiar both at the state level and also a community college kind of on-the-ground perspective. So first and foremost, Career Pathways is most well-known for our short-term credentials, which are stackable, that lead to certificates and associate's degrees in in-demand occupations with opportunities for advancement. But there's much more to it than just this. The model and initiative is successful because the approach integrates student success, college completion, access, equity and inclusion, and workforce development. It's helping get Oregonians into middle-skill jobs, and it is most certainly, and I think most importantly, addressing the needs of the 40-40-20 initiative. The history of the Career Pathways Initiative in Oregon is that it started in 2004 as a pilot with five colleges: Chemeketa, Lynn Benton Community College, Mount Hood Community College, PCC, and Southwestern Oregon Community College. At that time, it was funded from a grant from the governor's office. In 2006, it expanded to 12 colleges. And in 2007, it expanded to all 17 community colleges. So since 2007 until today, all 17 community colleges have been working on this initiative, doing various things across the continuum. The goal is to increase the number of Oregonians earning certificates, credentials, and degrees for in-demand occupations and within industry sectors. It's an innovative approach. All 17 community colleges are using the same systematic approaches to support student success. It's intended to articulate and ease the transition for students across the education continuum, from high school to community college, pre-college, including our adult basic ed, ESL, and dev ed programs, to the community college to university, and university to workforce, and various paths in between. All of this is achieved through the Career Pathways innovative approach and ability to connect systems. The Career Pathways model includes short-term stackable credentials and certificates, student support services, clear maps and pathways, and a sector strategy focus. It's implemented with different approaches across all 17 community colleges, as you can imagine, since different regions approach these things in different ways. But the bottom line is that the goal is to ease transitions and support progression along the college and career continuum. Career pathways meet the needs of incoming K-12 students, to incumbent workers wanting to advance their careers and go back for retraining. And in many cases, we are serving students who may not otherwise enroll or access college. And we do have a video for you from Lane Community College. And before we start, I just want to say that the student who speaks here became a pastry chef at a well-known winery in Lane County after finishing her Career Pathway certificate. And then she continued on to her Associate's in Applied Science degree.
Think going to college is just a dream? Think again. Career Pathways certificates from Lane Community College are designed to help you learn a specific set of skills for specific careers. When you complete the required courses, you'll be qualified for entry-level positions in high-demand fields. If you're already working, Career Pathways certificates can help you advance in your current job. Each Career Pathways certificate requires between 12 and 44 credit hours. If you enroll full-time, it's possible to complete some of these in a single term. Part-time students often complete theirs in 3 terms. And because every Career Pathways certificate course is part of a larger program, every credit you earn also gets you 1 credit closer to completing a degree at Lane. Lane works with employers, workforce and economic development agencies, high schools, and four-year institutions to create career pathway certificates in fields ranging from accounting to computer programming, construction to manufacturing, hospitality to healthcare. That means you'll have a foot in the door with a lot of industries to help you with basic employment or on-the-job training, a transition from high school and adult education programs, or plan to run your own business.
I wasn't sure what I wanted to do in college, but I tried some career pathway classes, fell in love with my field, and now I'm working on my 2-year degree at Lane. Thanks to the Career Pathway Certificate Program, I already have a job while I'm still enrolled in school. In a few years, I'd like to open up my own business.
Get your future on track with Career Pathways Certificates at Lane Community College. Start your career here.
So I'm going to take it from here. And just to back up a little bit, I have had the opportunity over the last 7 years at
Could you introduce yourself, Mark?
Yeah. Mark Goldberg again from Portland Community College, Associate Vice President for Workforce Development and Community Education. So I've had the opportunity over the past 7 years to work on career pathways at two different colleges, PCC and also Mount Hood Community College, and been an administrator in that time, overseeing programs that support students into training and into job opportunities in a variety of industry sectors. So just looking at the perspective from students when they're interested in career pathways, the whole community college system has a tool that we use that's called a roadmap. And what that is a way to show students how they can start their education and see when they begin in a career pathway, and they can take 4, 5, 6, 7 classes, 15 to 20 credits, maybe a few more, a few less, how that can lead to their first job opportunity in their industry field. So the roadmap on the right that you can see, there's a lot of boxes, it may be hard to see the details there, is an example from Rogue Community College. And it's an IT graphic web design roadmap. And so students can see from the top where they're starting, and the red level of boxes, the second level down, are the career pathway certificates. So students can take about 15 credits, a few classes, and then as you look to the right, that actually lists the job opportunities that they qualify for after completing those courses. And it's a live link, so students can see labor market information from the Oregon Labor Market Information Systems, from the Employment Department, and see what those jobs are, what the skills are, what the wages are, the number of postings, the projections into the future. So that's a starting point, and they can see what that first job is. But what's as important is that they can continue on and see if they enroll in further classes, they can work towards their next credential. And so that green level box is an example of a one-year certificate. And then as you follow it to the right, they can see the job opportunity at that level and what they qualify for. And as you can imagine, the wages will increase as they continue on with their education. And then the next level box is a two-year degree, again, with the jobs that they qualify for with further education. And what's great about the Rogue roadmap is that there's actually a bachelor's degree connected in this roadmap, and they're fortunate at Rogue that Southern Oregon University is so close by. So there's a connection to a bachelor's degree with the appropriate jobs tied into that education. And even in this case, they've got a graduate degree and the jobs there. So this is a really comprehensive tool that we use with students to help them navigate education and employment opportunities in the future. And this is just one example at one college in one industry, but this is replicated at all of our colleges for every single career pathway certificate and a requirement when we develop new certificates at the state. The other image on here is just a website that we have where students can go in and identify from all 17 colleges all the different career pathways options across the system. So this is a similar image, and this is something that was developed by the Center for Law and Social Policy at the federal level, and it's part of their Alliance for Quality Career Pathways framework. And Oregon, because of our career pathways efforts, has been able to participate in the development of this framework and really help lead it. And so this is another example that shows in the healthcare industry how the education stacks. And so students can get their first training into their first job. So it could be a healthcare bridge and an initial healthcare certificate leading to an entry-level job. And then they can continue on and work towards, say, a medical assistant, and then the job. So there's multiple entry and exit points on this continuum of education. What's key in this model is that the education is connected, it stacks, it's transparent, and students can see the credentials that are meaningful that lead to better job opportunities as they advance in the workforce. And it's key to the career pathways that it increases an individual's skills, competencies, and credentials, and that's informed by industry and employers. And it really makes college accessible, and it's designed for students to support completion and progression of their education. So we've got a list of a multitude of industry sectors that we have developed career pathway certificates in. So this is not just one program at one college or focusing on one industry similar to the K-12 conversation. We've got career pathways in a variety of industry sectors. It depends on the college and the key industries in the region. But we work very closely with with our employer partners, with our workforce boards, and really align sector strategies to develop these stackable credentials. And an important part of Career Pathways is not just that it's the education and training, but that we align with industry recognized credentials. So it's great for a student to get, say, a welding certificate at PCC or another college, but until they get an industry recognized credential, such as an American Welding Society credential, it's difficult to find a job without that industry credential. So that's embedded in many of these Career Pathways certificates. So we've got a list of some of the employers that have been involved in our Career Pathways efforts. Employer input is vital to the success of these Career Pathways certificates. So employers really work with us to identify what the skills, competencies, credentials are for their entry-level jobs and mid-level jobs. And from that, we're able to develop new Career Pathways certificates that align with those credentials. And there are a lot of ways that employers participate in these Career Pathways certificates beyond just the development of curriculum. They're also at times involved in career fairs that the colleges offer when students are getting ready to complete. And I think Skylar can speak to this. At times we'll have employers come into the classroom and give a presentation on job opportunities with their employer and some strategies to support students in applying for those jobs. At times we'll have employers host a tour of their facility so that students can see what it's like to work in a manufacturing environment, as one example. So there may be job shadowing tours, but as important as internships that we develop for students so that students do get the real work experience and an opportunity to try out employment for them, but also for the employer. And then lastly, the most important is that employers hire our graduates and solidify job opportunities for the students and fill their workforce needs.
Mark, can I just jump in? You know, for me, one of the real benefits of a career pathways model, you know, with sort of stackable credentials and kind of chunking the curriculum in that way, is the way it can align with an employer's efforts to create career ladders for their employees, for their incumbent employees. And I'm wondering if any of those partnerships are happening. You know, say we're a hospital partners with a college to help move, you know, a CNA to an LPN to an RN, you know, that sort of thing. If we're seeing examples of that kind of partnership.
Yeah, I can speak at the local level with Portland Community College. We've been involved in an initiative in healthcare, so that's a great example, in partnership with our workforce board, and Providence has been a key partner in really identifying what those entry-level positions are. And this grant has been youth-focused, but determining how we can get youth into their first job. And then we've continued to have dialogue with Providence to really map out what those career ladders are. I think it's still early discussions. The CNA to LPN to RN is a fantastic example, and it sounds good on paper, and it makes good sense, but in terms of getting the students from point A to point B and on takes a lot of coordination, both in work schedules for employees and also in the curriculum and allowing them to continue on towards that next level. So I think there's been some conversations. Healthcare is a great example. You know, there's also medical assistant, some of the other entry-level positions, and how we can continue to support incumbent workers in moving forward. So we've had some discussions at PCC, but I think that's a key part of Career Pathways. So many times we focus on the entry level, but we see the opportunity to continue on to the middle skill jobs and moving folks who are already working in into that level.
Thanks.
So just to move into how Career Pathways isn't just a workforce strategy, but it really does support student success. Currently, after a number of years with Community College Career Pathways programs, we have over 450 different options for Career Pathways certificates across the state. These are impressive outcomes, and as you can see, we've had over 14,000 individuals gain credentials in Career Pathways or less than 1 year certificates across all 17 colleges. So as we continue to focus on student success, college completions, and the needs of employers, this has led to over 3,500 completions in the last year, and you can see how that's grown exponentially over this time period. So starting with 587 in 08-09 and moving on to 3,500 in 14-15. So we really see Career Pathways credentials as supporting that middle 40 in the 40-40-20 initiative. And with that, I'll ask Skylar to speak at the faculty level next.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, and members of the committee. My name is Skylar Stearns. I'm a faculty member in the English as a Second Language Department and with Workforce and Economic Development at Portland Community College. And we thank you for your time today. I'd like to offer a faculty perspective on the Career Pathways model and what it looks like sort of on the ground for us and our students. One of the strongest elements of the Career Pathways model is the integrated approach that we have to learning. So in the support course that I teach, I'm not from the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning industry. However, I do now have training in it, and I have some experience in the trades. So in the support course I teach, we try to integrate English language and employability skills along with soft skills and HVAC knowledge, the technical knowledge. I work closely with the heating, ventilation, and air conditioning faculty in order to develop the materials that I use in my class. As a more concrete example, if I were to give a writing assignment in a class, all of the writing instruction I do uses heating, ventilation, and air conditioning as the subject matter. So they develop their core knowledge at the same time that they're developing their employability and their general skills. This approach allows me to address soft skills training in a more effective way, in my opinion. Soft skills are a difficult thing to teach. There's a lot of student resistance to these kinds of instruction because it's it can be a little condescending. People don't like to be told how to behave. They tend to take that personally. So, and in the integrated approach, we're able to model and to encourage proper soft skills as opposed to imposing them on students, and I found that that works very well, and we've had a lot of success there. Another benefit to the model is the cohort-based education. So our students start the program together. It tends to be a pretty intensive program, and they support each other through the program. A lot of our students are not real confident when they arrive in school for the first time or returning after long absences. The cohort-based approach allows students to identify ways that they can assist each other, and it also helps them to continue their education when they're finished because the students will continue learning together, we hope. A benefit of the model is a shorter path to success. So for a lot of students from the ESOL and adult basic ed areas, it can be a very long road ahead. There's a lot of discouragement that occurs when students realize how much preparatory education they need just to get an entry-level job, to be frank. With our approach, they can work on their job skills at the same time that they're working on the fundamental educational skills. That allows them to be much more invested in their educations, and it allows them to work on skills as they relate to a specific job. So instead of learning general language about every field in the world, we can teach specific HVAC-related language, which still includes all of the grammar and everything else, but it is immediately useful for the students. They're much more engaged with their studies, and they value them more. That, of course, translates into better student success and student outcomes. This path into the workforce is not a path that would exist for many of our students without Career Pathways. I work with refugees. I work with students who are coming out of the criminal justice system. I work with students who have a lot of different hurdles in their in entering the workforce. Our integrated approach allows flexibility to respond to those needs. So if a particular cohort needs more language development, I can focus there. However, if we need to focus more on soft skills development, I can adjust my instructional strategies to address those. One of the most rewarding parts for me as an instructor has to do with something that we've touched on already, and that's the stackability of our program and the components. Students are able to make real changes in their lives through career pathways, and one of the ways that they do that is incrementally. A short-term 3-month certificate might not seem like a lot if you have 16, 18, 20 years of education under your belt. But for a student who has never succeeded in the educational system at all, it's huge, and it can change their entire lives. So a small, short-term success that is a success in and of itself, but also leads to longer-term outcomes, is very motivating for the students, and it's very inspiring for me and for them as well. So most of my students in the past 2 years that I've taught this program have continued in their education. A lot of them have gone directly into the workforce, certainly an option, but the majority of them have done a combination of the two. So they are working during the day and going to school at night. The HVAC industry is booming right now. They need a lot of people. Employers, the last term we had an employer visit us almost every week to present and to recruit our students. And what they tell us consistently is that they need skilled workers. They need students who have had training and that are ready to go into the workforce. Our students come with the advantage of having been vetted already. So they have shown that they can complete tasks and they can follow through with what they say. So with that, I think I would like to turn it over to Marjanette, a graduate of our Career Pathways program.
Hey, welcome, Marjanette.
Thank you.
If you could just introduce yourself.
Yes. My name is Marjanette Ware. I'm a student at PCC. More importantly, I started in Career Pathways. I was laid off at my job after 24 years and decided to collect unemployment. At the unemployment department is where I met someone that hooked me up with PCC and the educational system that I could get through. When I first started, I had zero computer skills. Where I worked, we had people in the office that done that for us, and we just had to present it. Well, now I can do all of that myself and present it. I wanted some new options, so that's why I started with Career Pathways. I wanted to retrain for a different position. I have got my certificate as administrative assistant, and I'm working towards my associate's degree in business management. Career Pathways has just been like a savior for me, I guess. I didn't know which way I was going to go after the 24 years in one field. After I started Career Pathways, there are many fields opened up for me. And I graduated with certificates through the Career Pathways department, and now I'm going for my associates. Opportunities to apply the skills gained working at the office. I now am the front desk in the Career Pathways department. I'm very excited about it. I'm very excited about the training that I receive in there. It's going to help me go forward to whatever job that I land. I can take all of these skills with me. And someday, I hope to be an employee for the Career Pathways Department. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm sure you won't be the first. It's a great success story. Thank you, Marjanette.
Thank you.
Mark, so do you have some more? Or I see there are more slides, but we're actually going to have to move on.
Shorten it up.
Yeah. Okay. You just wrap up.
Sure. So, again, Dr. Allie McGinn, statewide director of Career Pathways.
Chair Dembrough, Senators. So I just want to say that I think this is evidence that this is clearly a proven strategy in terms of getting students into the continuum, getting them through, and getting them towards degree and towards the workforce. I do want to say that we have been nationally recognized, as you can note on the slide, by a number of important policy makers and folks nationally. We had some influence over the WIOA definition of the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act definition of career pathways, which is significant. And we are providing technical assistance to other states because our career pathways model has been so successful.
Mark Goldberg again from PCC. And I guess the one challenge for us is that we've had a successful initiative for many years, and we haven't had solid funding to support career pathways across the state. So colleges have found some resources to sustain it within their general fund. We had a National Department of Labor grant of $18.6 million, a tacked round one grant that supported career pathways with tremendous outcomes, but that grant ended. And so we've been able to get some funding through the strategic fund with the community college workforce development, but we hope to build on that and really grow and continue to support this successful model that has been recognized nationally. And a lack of funding and resources really jeopardized the Oregon Career Pathways Initiative and critical work beyond June of 2017 in this biennium.
Great. Well, I hope this will be part of the HEC budget request for next year in giving some stable funding to this program. Any quick questions, colleagues?
I just really appreciate the story of how it's worked for you. Thank you for taking time to come and tell us.
Having me.
Great. Okay, well, thank you all very much. Okay. So with that, I'll close that part of the hearing. I want to welcome colleagues Senator Bertschiger and Representative Vega Peterson, who wanted particularly to be part of the remainder of the program, which is the topic of immigrant farm and forestry workers, workplace safety, and wage and hour protections. And I will open this part of today's meeting. This is a topic that we've been hearing some concerns about challenges faced by immigrant workers here in our fields and forests, and wanted to hear directly from the workers about the challenges, as well as from the agencies how they are addressing those challenges, and from some of the employers who are dealing with this issue as well, and also to hear a little bit about a recent memorandum of understanding that was issued among some of the oversight agencies as to how they could better partner to make sure that workers are treated more fairly in our fields and forests. So we'll start with a panel of workers. And we can have all of these.
The four of them.
Okay. So I'm going to call up Ramon Gutierrez, please, and Andres Cortez, Carl Wilmson, and Joel Iboa.
Hi.
Hello.
My name is Ramon Gutierrez.
Yes. Okay, great. Welcome, all of you, to share your experience with us. Who is going to start us off?
Carl.
Carl?
Oh, I am? Oh, okay. Okay.
You want them to go first?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, Carl, if you could introduce yourself and tell us who you are.
Yeah. So my name is Carl Wilmson. I'm the executive director of the Northwest Forest Worker Center. We have been a registered nonprofit organization in Oregon since 1998. We advocate for forest workers and harvesters of non-timber forest products, including mushrooms, salal, huckleberries, and things like that in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. And I want to thank Senator Dembro and the other members of the committee here today for giving us this opportunity to testify. And we'd also like to thank Jan Norlin for her hard work in coordinating this hearing. So the first thing I want to say is that I want to be clear about the types of workers that we're talking about. When I say forest workers, I'm not talking about loggers. I'm talking about the ecosystem restoration workers, the workers who work in the forestry services industry. They're the ones who do the tree planting, the thinning, wildlife habitat improvement work, and all the other tasks necessary to tending Oregon's forests as well as forests nationwide. Today, the majority of these workers are Spanish-speaking immigrants from Latin America, and they have the whole full range of immigration status. A lot of them are here on H-2B visas, so-called guest workers. They're legal permanent residents, and they're also undocumented workers. The research that the Northwest Forest Worker Center has done in collaboration with the Labor Occupational Health Program at the University of California, Berkeley, as well as the Pacific Northwest Agricultural Safety and Health Center at the University of Washington, and also the Ecosystem Workforce Program at the University of Oregon, demonstrates that forest workers routinely experience wage theft, poor working conditions, high work-related injury and fatality rates, and constant fear of retaliation on the job. I'll just briefly give some of the findings of our research. Forest workers are often not paid for all the hours they work, and rarely receive overtime pay. The majority of forest workers do not get legally mandated rest breaks. Most do not get clean drinking water at the job site, and sleeping arrangements are often inadequate and overcrowded. Job-related injury and fatality rates, the official estimates put them at three times. The injury rate is three times the rate for average workers in Oregon, and the fatality rate is nine times as high. But those official estimates are probably low. For example, in one study that we conducted, 46% of the workers who had been injured in the previous year did not report their injury to their supervisor. So that's an indication that the official estimates are probably way too low. Most forest workers do not get adequate safety training for the work that they're doing. And many workers also report having to buy their own safety equipment, which is also contrary to Oregon law. One thing I'd like to point out is that our research indicates that forest workers experience these working conditions regardless of immigration status. Our research found no relationship between working legally under an H-2B foreign temporary visa in the United States or working as a forest worker under any other immigration status. One measure of how widespread these problems are is the fact that we interviewed workers in half of the forest contractors registered in Jackson and Josephine counties and found that workers in very high percentages of these companies reported conditions that are violations of the law. For example, I'll just give two examples. Workers in 90% of the companies in our sample said that they do not get rest breaks on the job. Workers in 62% of the companies said that they were not paid for all the hours they had worked in one or more pay periods during the previous 12 months. And this research was published in an article in the Journal of Forestry, which I'll be leaving here for all of you to read. That's published last year. So working conditions are bad. What's the solution? There are many good laws already on the books that are intended to protect forest workers and other workers. The problem is enforcement. One problem is that the enforcement agencies, Oregon OSHA and BOLI, are understaffed. So we would recommend increased budgets for the enforcement divisions of these agencies. Another problem is the U.S. Forest Service conducts regular inspections of the jobs that they have, but they inspect for proper completion of the specifications of the contract, not for labor law compliance. And so we would urge Oregon OSHA to start conducting joint inspections with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. One of the complaints we hear from workers over and over and over again is that they are told to lie at the hospital when they're injured and taken in for treatment of a work-related injury. The job foreman or company owner will tell them to say that they were cutting firewood at home or doing something else, that it's not a work-related injury. The boss will tell them, don't worry, I'll pay you for any time that you miss at work, but then fails to follow through on that promise. Doctor-patient communication is complicated by the fact that oftentimes the workers don't speak English, and the person who interprets for the worker is often a company employee, the job foreman or the boss or some other representative of the company. So if the worker is told to lie about his injury at the medical facility, how can we be sure that the company representative with him is accurately translating all communication between the doctor and patient? Oregon law is rather vague in this regard, so we would urge the legislature to strengthen the law and about provision of interpreters at medical care facilities, and to specifically prohibit a patient's employer or his or her representative from acting as an interpreter. And I will turn it over to Joel now.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. You are welcome.
Thank you so much for having us here, Senator Dembro, and the rest of the committee. I'm so glad to see Jessica Vega Peterson here today. I think it's emblematic since she was one of the first ones to want to hear about this important topic in Bend and then again at the House Energy and Environment Committee back in November. Yeah. My name is Joel Eboa, Environmental Justice and Community Outreach Manager for Beyond Toxics. I'm going to be covering the majority of recommendations today, the first of which is retaliation. Forest workers and other workers as well live under constant fear of retaliation for reporting their injuries to the supervisors. We have workplace rights, and they have the rights to enact those. And they have the right to seek improved working conditions. However, there is a wide shared understanding of among forest workers today and 20 years ago that if you get injured on the job, if you get sick, you'll most likely lose your job then, if not a week, 2 weeks, or a month later. Among the hundreds of forest workers that the Northwest Forest Worker Center has interviewed over the years, they have found very few instances of workers seeking to improve working conditions, even asking for rest breaks or for work to be done in a safer manner. Those who have done so have been very unsuccessful. Provisions in federal OSHA prohibit retaliation, as do Oregon statutes. However, unless an employer specifically tells a worker that he fired him or her because he or she got injured on the job, these provisions are very difficult to enforce. We therefore recommend that the Oregon legislature change the burden of proof in cases of worker retaliation so that employers have to prove that they did not retaliate versus the other way around. It's important to note this because the power dynamics between employers and employees are such that the employers will always have the upper hand. In September, we had the first ever Justice for Land and the Worker event in Medford, and we heard there from 12 workers. What struck me the most was that many of the workers said they didn't have basic provisions at the workplace, water and a bathroom. In one study, the Northwest Forest Worker Center did, more than half the workers interviewed said they did not have access to potable drinking water, but instead had to drink out of mountain streams. A realistic solution must be found that would include requiring worker crews to carry water purification systems with them, such as filters or ultraviolet purifiers, and to dedicate a crew member to supplying the crew with fresh, treated water. There's the issue of bathrooms. We all need to use them. Most forest workers reply that they do not have access to even porta potties. A lot of employers argue that this requirement is simply unrealistic given the nature of where they're working. In addition, it is rare for workers to be supplied with sanitation kits for washing up before they eat their meals, which state law requires in situations where it is impractical to make washing facilities available. Once again, we need better enforcement. We recommend an easy fix would be to supply crews with water purification kits and sanitation. The next issue we at Beyond Toxics have, as well as the Northwest Forest Worker Centers, is the issue of pesticides. It is true that very little research has been done on pesticide exposure and related health problems among forest workers. The perceived wisdom is forest workers mostly work with herbicides, which are thought to be non-toxic to humans. However, studies have linked herbicides to non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, respiratory ailments, skin lesions, eye damage. In addition, forest workers do sometimes apply rodenticides and insecticides, which have been demonstrated to be toxic to humans. Finally, many of these workers clean their clothes in commercial laundries or hotel laundromats and have not been trained to prevent pesticide contamination of washers, which could then affect another segment of workers that are often targeted and mistreated, which are hotel workers. We recommend that a licensing system that requires all applicators of pesticides to be licensed, not just under the provision of a licensed applicator, but one that will go further than that. The minimum would be that the ODA issue a license type and be a supervised pesticides trainee. The final point that I'll make today is on accommodations. I oftentimes travel for work and am provided with the ability to rent a hotel room with a private bathroom for myself. This is not a luxury that workers in the forestry section are given. Many of them are put in crowded motel rooms, and there are oftentimes more than 3, 4, 5, and I think Virginia has mentioned up to 10 workers in one room. She has seen it herself. Again, the underlying theme of all these recommendations is that there must be better enforcement tools. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joel. Before we go on, before we actually hear from the workers, could you or Carl just say something about, you've mentioned the company and who are we talking about? So are we talking about contractors? Are we talking about the actual representatives of the Forest Service, the BLM, et cetera? Who is the company here?
We're talking about contractors. So these are private companies that contract with federal land management agencies, the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management, and also sometimes with the state, and also with private landowners to do the work. And so they hire the crews, and then they contract with those, with the landowners.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. And Virginia, you're going to translate?
Or? Yes. Uh-huh. My name is Virginia Camberos, and I'm the program coordinator for the Northwest Forest Worker Center, and I will be translating for these two gentlemen here.
Okay. Mi nombre es Andrés Cortés. Mi nombre es Andrés Cortés, y tengo trabajando 13 años en reforestación.
My name is Andrés Cortés, and I have been a forest worker for the last 13 years.
Y pues vengo aquí a decirle que pues nos dan un trato muy inadecuado.
I'm here to tell you that we've given a treatment very inadequate in that work field.
Y pues que no hay una inspección adecuada.
There are no adequate inspections.
Como de los 13 años que tengo trabajando, he trabajado con varias compañías.
In the 13 years that I've worked with several different companies.
Y en ningún momento he yo visto que una inspección.
I have never seen any inspection being done.
Y pues es, en veces no nos dan el equipo adecuado.
They don't give us the right equipment.
Y hace que uno tenga accidentes.
That is part of the reason that we have accidents.
Y pues también que nos presionan mucho para hacer más trabajo del que podemos hacer.
And we're always given too much pressure, you know, to do a lot more work than we can.
Y pues de por sí es un poco difícil el trabajo que hacemos por el equipo que cargamos y las.
It's very difficult for us because the equipment that we carry.
Y las áreas que.
And the areas that we work in.
Y pues con la presión es. Uno tiene muchos accidentes.
And because of the pressure, you know, that's part of the reason that we have so many accidents.
A mí me tocó tener un accidente.
I had an accident.
Se me cayó un árbol encima. Y
I had a tree. I had a tree that fell on my foot and it fractured it.
Y pues es por la misma presión que nos ponen.
Because it's the same pressure that they put on us.
No nos tratan como personas ni.
They don't treat us like we were people.
Y pues también no. Del todo el tiempo que tengo trabajando en ninguna compañía me han dado break.
In the whole years that I've worked with a company, I have never had a rest break.
Ni overtime.
And they've never paid my overtime.
Nada. Y pues también me gustaría que pues que nos den una capacitación para los mayordomos y tanto para los un entrenamiento para los trabajadores.
I would like to see that even the supervisors get these trainings and also the employees get trainings.
Okay, pues cuando vamos al trabajo no nos nada más nos dicen haz esto, pero no nos dicen cómo hacerlo.
When we get to a job site, all they say is just get to work and they don't give us any training on how to do the work.
Y pues también que nos hacen bullying y nos amenazan con despedirnos.
And of course, you know, they bully us and they always threaten us that they'll fire us.
Y pues por eso es que la mucha gente no habla.
That's part of the reason that, you know, many of us don't speak out.
Pero hoy estamos aquí para pues para que si nos pueden escuchar y nos pueden ayudar.
That's why we're here today, so that you can hear us and, you know, you can help us.
Y porque pues solamente ustedes nos pueden ayudar.
Because we feel that you're the ones that can help us.
Ya que pues hay muchas leyes, pero ellos no las respetan.
There are so many laws, but they're not being respected.
Y en algunas veces también, cuando tiene uno accidentes.
And also when we have accidents.
Lo llevan a uno y lo hacen que uno diga que se lastimó en trabajo propio de uno.
And because they make us lie that, you know, whenever we get hurt, that we have to say that we hurt ourselves somewhere else.
Y pues me gustaría que todo eso cambiara para que pueda uno trabajar mejor y pues más adecuado los trabajos.
I'd like for, you know, those things to change so that we can have a better, you know, work site, workplace.
Y pues también que cuando uno se accidenta lo sigan apoyando así como cuando uno les puede ayudar a trabajar.
And so when we do have accidents that we get that same support like when we're out there working out in the field.
Gracias por escucharnos.
Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cortez. Mr. Gutierrez.
Buenos días. Mi nombre es Ramón Gutiérrez y hoy venimos a pedir que nos ayuden.
My name is Ramón Gutiérrez and I'm here for asking for your help.
Venimos a contarles que en este tipo de trabajo nos tratan muy mal.
Just to come to tell you that in this type of work we're mistreated very much.
Casi como animales.
Almost like animals.
Y pues no somos animales.
And we're not animals.
Y pues son muchas las injusticias que hay en la sierra y nadie dice nada porque siempre tiene la gente miedo de hablar.
These things happen, you know, in the forestry, and, you know, people are just afraid to talk, and, you know, all these injustices that happen in the forest.
Nos tratan mal.
They treat us bad.
No nos dan el agua que debemos tomar, nos dan del arroyo.
They don't give us the proper drinking water. We drink from the creeks.
y el equipo necesario también no lo tenemos todo el tiempo.
And the necessary equipment that we need.
Y ellos quieren que rendamos, y cómo rendimos si no tenemos el equipo necesario para rendir.
How can we work, you know, and do the job if we don't have the right equipment for us to do the job?
Y es cuando pasan los accidentes porque uno está forzado.
That's why these accidents happen because we're being forced.
A mí me tocó que teníamos 25 días trabajando.
We were working for about 25 days.
En los lumbres en California.
The fires in California.
Y como es para el gobierno, ahí sí nos tratan bien.
And because it's for the government, you know, we're treated better there.
Y tuve un accidente.
And I had an accident.
Me quebré mi mano.
I broke my arm and
me hicieron cirugía.
I had surgery in my arm in three places.
Y el doctor dice que ya no voy a poder trabajar en el mismo trabajo.
The doctor states that I will never be able to do this work again.
Porque se me partió en tres pedazos mi mano.
In three places it was broken.
Y y por eso queremos que nos ayuden porque el me trataron bien en donde andábamos trabajando porque era para el gobierno.
Because they treated me well where, you know, we were working for the government.
Pero cuando llegué a Medford,
when I got to Medford,
ellos se olvidaron de mí, me mandaron,
they forgot about me.
Me mandaron a un lugar a curarme, pero estaba cerrado.
They sent me to a place to supposedly get healed, but it was closed.
Y me mandaron y pues mi esposa no sabía manejar y le tocó manejar.
My wife didn't even know how to drive, but she drove and took me.
Y teníamos nuestro niño recién nacido y pues es difícil.
And we had a newborn baby at the time.
Y lo que más me duele es que nunca pude cargar mi niño cuando estaba chiquito.
What hurts me the most is that I was never able to carry my child, my newborn baby.
Y hace aproximadamente como un mes.
About a month ago.
Un amigo tuvo un accidente en la sierra.
One of my friends had an accident in the forest.
Y no le hicieron caso.
And they didn't listen to him.
Y él decidió mejor quitarse la vida.
And he then decided to take his own life.
Y y por eso venimos hoy, para que nos escuchen y nunca vuelva a pasar eso, porque es un dolor tan grande que no queremos que vuelva a pasar.
That's why we're here, because we want you to hear us, and we don't ever want this to happen again.
Y ojalá y nos puedan escuchar y
we hope that you can hear us.
Y queremos también que nunca, cuando vayan a chequear las compañías, nunca les hablen antes de ir, porque siempre les hablan y ellos se preparan.
He also says that, you know, whenever there's going to be an inspection, the supervisors are always told that they're going to come and inspect, that shouldn't happen. They shouldn't be calling to do an inspection.
Please listen to me, because for that my friend has died. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gutierrez. And both of you, thank you very much for coming forward. Yes, Senator Butcher.
to the young man, Gutierrez.
Yeah.
Lo siento. You talk about equipment you didn't have.
What del equipo que no te han dado.
What equipment did you not
have?
A veces que uno quiere pedirles una cadena para el serrucho, una lima para afilar o para.
It's because sometimes we need the chains, or we need the to sharpen the files to sharpen the saws.
Pero cuando uno les pide las cosas, a uno en vez de darles, primero lo tienen que regañar o.
He says every time we ask for anything like that, they're always, you know, like threatened, or they're being, you know, told, you know, like you know, telling them.
Bully en frente de la gente.
They're bullying them in front of them, and they won't give them that equipment.
¿Cómo pides algo?
That's why they don't ask.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions of this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Thatcher, please.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to remember names. I think Andres said you never saw inspections. And Ramon, I think, said that inspections were kind of announced ahead of time, which gave the employers a heads up. So how many inspections did you actually get to see?
Tú no viste ninguna inspección. Tú viste, pero porque les avisan.
Cuando nos avisan, cuando chequean otra compañía o algo, siempre nos avisan, pónganse todo, o nos llevan cosas nuevas para.
¿Cuántas veces?
Como
nunca nos han inspeccionado, pero siempre nos dicen ya inspeccionaron otro lado o así.
Because he says that they hear, you know, the supervisors hear that they're being another company's being inspected in the area, so they're being told, oh, get ready, you know, and they're giving them new equipment so that they can, you know, if they come and inspect them, then, you know, they can see that they're working with the right equipment that they need.
But he says he's never seen an inspection. So
Right.
Okay. And I guess I'm wondering what inspections were they hearing about? Were they from like the like safety people, sort of like OSHA, or was it from labor department?
They're all afraid of OSHA, all the owners and, you know, supervisors, but they never come, is what he says.
Interesting. Okay, thanks.
Senator Rosemary, did you have a question?
I just want to thank you for coming forward. It takes a lot of courage to tell a story like this and to make things better for the other workers.
Para poder hacerlo mejor para otros trabajadores. Que gracias por venir.
Es nuestro propósito.
That's our plan, he says.
Que nunca vuelva a pasar nada.
Because we don't want this to happen to us or to anybody else.
Right.
Oh, one more question.
Yes, please.
I think it was Ramon mentioned something about working for the state of California. And because he was working for them, he was treated better. And I wondered what specific things were so different between the two.
Tú dices que estuvo trabajando en California, tú, ¿verdad? ¿Dónde te pasó la lesión? Era federal.
Sí, es para el gobierno, como son las lumbres que se prenden en los cerros.
Sí, he was working for federal because of the fires in California, and that's where he had his accident there.
But what made it better, I guess, specifically?
¿Qué fue lo que hizo mejor? Porque ahí sí fue, te llevaron al hospital y todo, pero...
Pues ahí como estaba el gobierno, pues me tuvieron que llevar al hospital, pero nomás para ponerme un yeso para cubrirme.
He said that what they did is that they took him there to the hospital and all just to put a cast on it, but he wasn't going to be attended even more. He had to wait until he went into Medford to do that.
Ella dice en cuanto al trabajo, ¿cuáles son las diferencias en el tratamiento, en el trabajo?
Oh, en el trabajo en el que siempre trabajamos, que privado. Diferente, que no es para el gobierno. Siempre nos tratan como animales y cuando trabajamos para el gobierno siempre recibimos el trato justo.
Says that if it's for a federal, you know, they get treated better, but if they work for a private, you know, companies, that they're mistreated more badly.
Mm-hmm. And so just to clarify, so for the follow-up care, you know, by then he was already working for his former employer in Medford. And that's where he didn't get the follow-up care.
Right. Cuando te mandaron de California, te viniste a... Eso sí deberías de platicar porque esa es la que más... Es bien difícil.
Cuando salí del hospital.
When he left the hospital from California.
Salí como a las 12 de la noche.
I came out about midnight and there were no taxis.
Y tenía mi mochila, mi ropa. I had my backpack. Las lumbres.
My clothes from the fires.
Yo con mi mano entrelazada. Y todavía cargando mi mochila, mi casco.
I had to carry my headgear, my backpack, and ¿cómo andabas vestido?
En short.
I was wearing shorts.
With boots.
With boots.
Very funny. Yes. Y iba caminando por la calle.
I was walking through the street with the supervisor in the street.
Yeah, porque no había taxis.
Because there were no taxis.
Y pasaron dos en un carro.
Two people went by.
Y nos gritaron que vagabundos y muchas cosas. Y ellos sin saber que yo iba con mi mano del hospital y cargando todo. Y
they didn't know any better. I mean, they were yelling all sorts of stuff, us being vagabonds or something. But my arm was all broken in three places, right?
Yeah.
Y luego...
Y pues el mayordomo se enojó y pues yo también, yo no sabía ni qué hacer porque fue cargando las cosas y con mi mano quebrada y a las 12 de la noche caminando
carrying all that stuff and, you know, my broken arm and walking through the street to ¿a dónde fueron?
Un hotel, a buscar un hotel para quedarnos.
We were looking for a hotel, trying to find a place to stay.
Caminamos como unas 3 millas, yo creo.
We walked about 3 miles with my broken arm.
This was in California?
In California.
Yeah.
In California.
And were you working for a contractor there?
¿Estabas trabajando para un contratista allí?
Era para el gobierno.
For the government, mm-hmm. federal.
But through a contractor or directly employed?
Directo de un contratista que los contrató a ustedes para ir a hacer...
La compañía que trabajaba aquí.
With the same company that he was working here.
Okay.
Can I just clarify?
Oh.
So the way it works is that the contracting companies are, a lot of them are based in Medford or in the Rogue Valley, but they contract all over the western United States. And so a lot of them do firefighting, not all of them do, but it depends on the contract. They'll go to to Montana, Idaho, California, Washington. They go all over the West. So it's the workers will work for one company, but they might be working in several different states. And of course, here in Oregon as well.
¿Puedo decir algo más?
I want to say one more thing.
Y por la misma presión del trabajo, mi hermano se cortó con el serrucho un pie.
The same, because of the same pressures of the, you know, the work, my brother cut his foot.
Y desafortunadamente él no puede, no siente dos dedos.
He doesn't, he's not able to feel his two of his toes now.
Y pues es triste.
And it's very sad for me.
Okay, I want to thank you all very much for coming forward, and hope you're able to stay around and listen to the comments that follow, and yes. Let's stay in touch, please.
Thank you.
Right,
thank you very much.
Thank you.
So it's just Ben?
Yes.
Okay. All right, next up we have Ben Duncan, chair of the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force. Ms. Duncan, thank you very much for coming.
Morning, Chair Denbrough, Senators, Representative. My name is Ben Duncan. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force. And I just want to also say that, you know, I so much appreciate and reflecting on the power of the stories of impacted people. That's part of the principles and values of environmental justice, is that we hear directly from communities most impacted. The EJ Task Force was created by the legislature to help protect Oregonians from disproportionate environmental impacts on minority and low-income communities, including tribes and other vulnerable populations. Environmental justice is equal protection from environmental and health hazards and meaningful public participation in decisions that affect the environments in which people live, work, learn, practice spirituality, and play. Environmental justice communities include minority and low-income communities, tribal communities, and other communities traditionally underrepresented in public processes. In hearing the testimony today, we should all understand that we have low-income and minority communities that are disproportionately burdened by producing and picking the food we eat and maintaining the forests that support local economies across our state. As the chair of the Environmental Justice Task Force, I've had the opportunity to hear direct testimony from the communities engaged in farm and forestry work, and Joel talked about the meeting in September where we heard testimony from folks doing this work at the EJ Task Force. And we've had the chance to engage in dialogue with organizations that represent these workers. My goal today is to highlight opportunities that we have to focus our workforce equity and our environmental justice strategies, to put workers in a better position to succeed by improving outreach and education, or outreach and engagement, education and training, and by protecting workers' rights to support stronger, more equitable jobs for the future. So we must improve our communication with workers and impacted communities to better educate them about their rights and the ways that various state agencies can assist them. Even today, as we've heard, many workers in these communities are not fully apprised of the rights and available resources. They experience intimidation and fear, which leads to unequal protection, confusion, and distrust. We must shift our inspection and enforcement resources to prioritize those communities that are most vulnerable to wage theft, to unreported injuries, to retaliation, and environmental hazard. And we heard that very clearly from our previous speakers. While resources are limited, we can and should do better for these unprotected communities that are so critical to our local and our state economy and our livelihoods. And we must strengthen training resources and opportunities for workers and employers alike, making sure to reflect the cultural norms and diversity of our farm and forestry communities and increase their capacity to better protect their rights and their interests. So improved outreach and engagement, equal enforcement of worker protection standards, and culturally relevant and sufficient trainings. This is a balanced approach that works across many sectors. And if we apply this approach to our farm and forest workers, we can minimize the disproportionate harm and ensure increased health and opportunity. So I want to thank you, particularly Senator Dembro, for bringing these issues to the forefront. The EJA Task Force will continue to work with our partners in communities across Oregon, but also our state agency partners, including the Department of Agriculture, Oregon OSHA, Bureau of Labor and Industries, to make sure that we advance policies and practices that reflect our shared value and our commitment to protect all Oregonians. So thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ben. I do have a question. So I was told that recently the EJA Task Force had a meeting focused on this particular issue.
Yeah.
What were your chief takeaways from that?
Well, I think I laid them out. I mean, I think what we heard today is symbolic and reflective of the many stories that we heard. I think for some of us, as we were reflecting as a task force, the level of impact was astounding. The variety of stories, the variety of impacts, the trauma that these communities are experiencing, the lack of confidence and faith in agencies that are responsible for protecting them, I think that we were startled by that. But what we also heard, I think, is incredible resilience, persistence and perseverance in the face of all that. These are workers that are doing, you know, literally back-breaking labor and continue to have the courage to come forward despite all the risks that they've described. So I think for us, you know, we see opportunities to have stronger focus, recognizing that these are some of the most vulnerable communities in our state that are doing critical work for our state. So I think for the task force, we see lots of opportunity to do better.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Knope.
Thank you. Ben, how often does the environmental task force meet?
We meet quarterly. Sometimes we'll have an additional meeting.
So follow up?
Please.
Yeah. So Ben, I'm on the Environmental Justice Task Force webpage, and I'm trying to follow the conversation in your meetings, and there's nothing listed for 2015. Is there a reason for that?
Well, what I would suggest is that, you know, perhaps we need more resources for the task force to support kind of ongoing updates of our meeting minutes. I'm happy to go back and share them. There's a delay between when we meet and when those meetings and minutes get posted.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yes. If we could we get like agendas and meeting minutes from 2015? Because it looks like the website kind of stops in 2014 in about October.
Yeah,
and even then there's no minutes, there's just an agenda, and so it would be great to see like what kind of work you guys are doing. Sure. And what you're following, so we can follow that conversation a little better.
I'll respectfully decline of commenting on the resources available to the governor's natural resource office, but surely I think we're seeing where we could add resources to support this work.
Yeah, and we'll stay on top of that and send out a link once those are posted.
Another question?
Yes, Vice Chair.
Well, sort of along that that line, what I just pulled up an annual report from 2012-2013. Is that something that that you don't need to do anymore, or is that are there reports for 2014? Or
there are, whether they're on the website.
Oh, okay. They are available somewhere.
Yeah, and the task force, we're not necessarily, I guess, individually responsible for maintaining and updating the website. We share minutes, we collect minutes, we, you know, follow all the kind of rules of voting and decision making. So there are annual reports we're working on this year to submit to the governor. That also includes reports from each of the 14 designated natural resource agencies about their work to advance environmental justice. But you know, I can only apologize that there's a not just a delay, but a gap in some of the information that would be valuable for this committee and communities.
Great. Okay, thank you very much,
yeah,
Ben,
appreciate
for
it.
Coming forward. Yeah. Okay, Senator Bratcher, you want to go down? So as some of you know, our own Senator Bertschinger has a very intimate awareness of the challenges around this issue because he himself works in this industry. So it's been our pleasure to have him up here with us, but now he is going to share his expertise as a person in the field.
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. Thank you for the introduction. I guess I'm going to talk about my real job here. You know, the testimony we heard here.
I think you have to introduce yourself.
Oh, Senator Herman Bertschinger, District 2. Thank you. The testimony we heard earlier is pretty disturbing. There's no question about it. The allegations and the testimony from those incidents is somebody that has employed people in the forest industry for 40 years. That's not acceptable, period. To get started, I'll tell you a little bit about my background. Right out of high school, I went to work in the woods. I spent my entire career there. I owned a company for about 38 years. I've just kind of stepped down from that, and my sons have taken that over. They've downsized and taken it over. I think I've had a pretty good career. There's been some bumps and bruises and broken bones along the way, but all in all, for all those years and all those hours of labor in one of the most hazardous environments. They're the most hazardous jobs. So you just look, the timber industry is. We've done pretty good, and I'm very thankful for all those employees, the ones that are now passed on. When you employ people that long, some of them disappear, unfortunately. I actually had some people work for. I had a gentleman work for me until he was 80 years old. He's still around. He's 94 now. But anyways, so let's talk a little bit about this industry, what these folks testified about. It is a very hazardous industry. As I kind of narrow down to the H-2B program, I would never be in favor for any type of guest worker program that replaced domestic labor. It's simply, I would not. I'd be adamantly against it. But the H-2B program is actually a program that can be implemented when there is a labor shortage. And I'll talk a little bit about that labor shortage. When you look at some of the statistics of labor shortage from the U.S. Department of Labor, our labor has been declining. Our workforce has been declining since 1982. And now we are losing about 500,000 people out of our labor force every year. And that will continue on until, well, the estimates, as we all know how those are, until the year 2022, and then it kind of flatlines. And so there is a shortage of labor. I've experienced it in the last few years as we've tried to attract employees to our business. It's tough. It is tough. I've never participated in the H-2B program simply because it's a very... it's a very hard program to administer. It takes a lot of time, and I just didn't want to get involved with it. But I have, in recent years, since I've kind of shifted into the training, and I train hundreds and hundreds of people in all different types of jobs in the timber industry, from chainsaw operations to wildland firefighting. When you work with, you see the labor shortage with these companies. I work for many different companies. And the H-2B program can be, if administered correctly, a pretty good program. And I do a lot of training for H-2B folks out there. And, you know, when I hear these stories, and, you know, throughout the last 40 years, I've heard similar stories here and there. I can't point to one and say I know of directly, but I've heard some things. That's okay. No matter what industry you're in, you're going to have a few bad actors. And I think what we're trying to get at is how do we shore that up so this doesn't continue on. But go back to what I heard here on training and or lack of training. We have to remember there's two types of training. We have formal training, where we have classroom training, which is a good baseline. Then we have the, I call it informal training, which is the on-the-job training. 30 years ago, you basically didn't have any classroom training. Everything was on-the-job training. And I'm not advocating that we don't have classroom training. Don't get me wrong. That's kind of my job now. But it's just a baseline. You can actually have pretty good training on the job. The H-2B program, if you have an understanding, you have to remember these are not undocumented workers. These are documented workers with a visa to work for a period of time for a certain contractor who has provided the government that they have the jobs, they have the contracts, and they've provided the government through certain means that they cannot fulfill that workforce. That's how that program works. And it's a good program if it is administered correctly. Another thing I'd like to touch on, and it's kind of sensitive, and I've thought really hard how to do this because it's very sensitive to me, is the article that kind of spurred this. And we read these articles and we wonder about, you know, the validity of the information, and you know, we all of us legislators, we read all kinds of stuff and we scratch our head, is this true or not true? And I can't say that everything in that article was not true or everything was true, but one thing that stuck out when they talked about the young man who lost his life in Brookings, Oregon, and they portrayed it as the company just threw him out there with no experience, all by himself, and he got hurt and he died on the scene, you know. That's simply not true. And the reason I know that is I was hired by that company to investigate that workplace, and make recommendations of how to avoid these situations. That was a very, and I'm not trying to diminish that incident at all, because that young man left a wife and a couple kids, okay? But to say it was the company's fault is absolutely wrong, okay? It was, nobody knows what happens. And he had all of his personal protection equipment. The equipment he was running was all functioning perfect. And the injury he sustained was really not consistent with what we see with chainsaw injuries. It was an accident. And nobody knows exactly what happened. Okay? And I don't want to diminish that, but I want to make sure everybody knows that it wasn't really how it was written in that article. And that's not fair. If we're going to make decisions as legislators, we have to have the facts and the truths. And that's how we make good decisions. So with that, I'll wrap it up by saying, you know, I'll never support a program that replaces domestic workers. But this particular program, the H-2B, is a useful program. And we have to be conscious. Americans, us, who work in other countries, use this same program in other countries. We have to get work visas when we go to other countries. So it's not like it's just the United States that has guest workers. There's many Americans across this globe working in other countries on work visas. That's what this is, and it's not a bad program if administered correctly. So with that, I'll entertain any questions or dance on the table. I don't know, whatever you want me to do.
Yeah. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Excuse me. We heard from a number of people that indicates there's a problem with at least a few companies out there. What would you suggest to fix that, like the issues of maybe not knowing what your work site, you know, being allowed breaks and some basic necessities, perhaps, as well as having your safety equipment, not, you know, being told to lie when you go to the hospital? Do you think it's a matter of education for the companies to make sure that, and for the workers, so they know what their rights are, and so they're, I mean, because there are a lot of laws out there preventing retaliation, all that, but it sounds like there's a disconnect somewhere. And so I'm just wondering, based on what we heard, what would you suggest to fix that?
Well, one of the companies that use me as a consultant, we have an orientation program and a safety program, and some of that I teach, and it's a long day. I just did one last week for about 84 H-2B workers. And not only we talk about, you know, a safe work environment and what they should have, their equipment, how to run the equipment, stuff like that, we also touch on many other things. We touch on first aid stuff. We touch on evacuation. We make sure that everybody knows, that every person on that crew knows, not just a supervisor or a couple people. Everybody has that knowledge. And, you know, we do touch on workers' rights to some extent, what the expectations are and things like that. And we call that a situation awareness complexity checklist is what we call that. And we go through all of that, of what, you know, if something happens to an employee, he's supposed to talk to his supervisor is supposed to react a certain way. So we try to get this information out. So, because you have to remember, with some of these workers coming from another country, the culture is completely different. Completely different. They're not used to this. And so we try to bring that on. Now, you also have to remember, is we're dealing with a workforce that's probably from the age of 18 to 27, somewhere in there. And some of them don't come back the next year, so, you got a big turnover. So you have to do it every single year, is before these workers go in the workplace. And that employer has to pay them to attend that. So you got to remember, the time that employer pays for that person, from the time they cross the border, they have to pay their travel expenses, they have to pay them while they're here, make sure they're housed correctly. I heard some testimony on bad housing, and that's not acceptable. And they have to pay them their way back. If they're from Mexico or Guatemala or whatever, the employer has to make sure they get back. It's not a bad program, okay? It really isn't. You know, it sounds to me like we're having some problems in the enforcement area. And I think that's the direction that maybe we should all look at.
Senator, let me follow up. And, you know, the challenge, you know, we heard about the challenge of fear of retaliation, mm-hmm. right? And so presumably, you know, obviously people who are working in an undocumented situation will have a lot of concern about complaining. But potentially the same could be true of those who are here on the H-2B visa. You know, they might fear that they'll be sent back to their country because they're here on a contract with this employer. So, I mean, how do we deal with that potential vulnerability? How do we compensate for that?
You know, through education, Senator Dembro, I told you, there's a culture difference, okay? And the way things are done in the country that they come from and the way we do things in our country is different. And the only way to do that is to educate them. And that's why, you know, in my program, we touch on some of that, the responsibilities of the employee and the responsibilities of the employer. We do talk about that. Now, whether that individual utilizes that and really feels comfortable, because it's not something that he would experience or she would experience in their country, whether, I don't know how to fix that. I don't know. And, you know, an employer that does that, in my opinion, should not be an employer, period. You know, I think if you're an employer that looks at your employees as employees and not as people, maybe shouldn't be an employer, because they're people. Sure, they're employees, but they're people. They all have lives. They all have, you know, their troubles, trials and tribulations and all that other stuff. They're not a widget. You know, they're people. And so, you know, how do we fix that? That's a good, it's tough. All we can do is keep trying, you know, keep trying. But there is a cultural difference, and that's a struggle.
Well, thank you very much, Herman, for taking that long walk down there, and now you're welcome to come back up here.
I'm gonna ask myself a question.
Okay, our next panel, we have a couple of employers. We have Michael Wheelock, please. Yeah, come on up. And Evel Salgado.
Corey will take it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, both of you. We just heard from someone who works or worked as an employer in this industry, or he purports to have worked in this industry. But now you can give us the perspective of people who are working full-time in this industry now.
Well, thank you, Senator Dembro, and the rest of the committee. I'm Abel Salgado with Oregon Forest Management Services. I'm a contractor and operator. I've been doing this working in this industry for about 28 years. I worked for several different companies before I became an owner of the same company that I work for right now. Like I said, I worked 5 years for different companies, and you know, I cannot say anything negative about all the companies that I work for. I was treated right all the time, and so now that I am owner of my own company, I try to treat my employees fair, because I was an employee for a long time. So it makes me sad to hear all these stories from different people. So I try to do something different for my employees, be fair to them, and because I know they got kids, they got families like I do. So, and I just wish that there's several laws, and I'm aware of all those laws, and they just need to be enforced so this doesn't keep happening. And that's pretty much all I got to say. Just, you know, we just need to focus on the issue.
Thank you. Let's hear from Mr. Wheelock, and then I think we have some specific questions for
okay.
you.
Thank you, Committee, and Senator Dembro for allowing me to testify, and Jan for putting all this together. I have deep-seated passion about this. I used to be a smoke jumper, worked for the Forest Service, and then I got into this industry, and I was appalled at the treatment of workers, particularly the Hispanic workers in this industry. I concluded that it's equal to slavery in modern-day United States, and you wouldn't think that would happen here. I'm one of the largest employers in this industry. I have 200 full-time workers. Most of them have been with me 20, 40 years. I have offices in LeGrand, John Day, Medford, Grants Pass.
Mr. Wheelock, I'm sorry. I forgot to ask you to introduce yourself for the record, please.
Oh, okay. My name is Mike Wheelock. I am president of Grayback Forestry.
Thank you.
And we've been around since 1979. One of the first things I heard when I came to Oregon or started business was that I was having trouble competing against contractors. And I would bid $100 an acre, and they would bid $50, and I couldn't understand because I had a lot of hardworking people work for me. And then I started hearing some of the horror stories, like they'd worked folks for 2 months in the wilderness out in Happy Camp, California, very little camping equipment, et cetera. And after 2 months, they'd call immigration and have them pick them up without any pay. Stuff like that was commonplace. Mm-hmm. So we fought hard in the 80s and 90s to change some of these atrocities that were happening in the industry. And we did, through lots of hard work, getting the Forest Service, OSHA, Bureau of Labor, U.S. Department of USDOL, OSHA. And when they worked together as a task force, they got something done. But what I'm seeing is it's gotten these contractors have gotten more sophisticated, and the abuses are continuing on. I will say that not all contractors are like that, like the gentleman next to me, Senator Herman. there's a lot of good companies out there, but there's a lot of them abusing the situation. There's three types of work that these workers are doing, and there's the traditional reforestation, forestry, tree planting, and then there's fuels management, fuels mitigation, and then there's wildfire suppression. And wildfire suppression has just grown to a $50, $80 million industry, and there's abuses there, as the one gentleman told you. They are a little better because the Forest Service is there watching over these. But these guys will charge them for meals when we're giving to them free. They pay them day rates. They pay them under the table. They don't pay fringe benefits. And one of my big pet peeves is they don't get paid the overtime when they go to California. I guarantee you that 80-90% of the contractors are required by California law to pay overtime. Anything over 8 is double. Anything over 12 is double. And anything over 6 days is double. It's completely ignored in industry. The industry knows it. They just fail to do it. And the Bureau of Labor can get with Oregon Department of Forestry, that can get with California and make this happen. It's not that big of a deal. Once a few examples are made, I guarantee you contractors will pay, and it'll equal out the playing field. One of the big things that I see is the underreporting of workman's comp claims, as noted with these individuals. The pure rate for workman's comp in the state of Oregon for reforestation, the 0124 code, is $7 per $100. Logging is around $22 per $100 in payroll. The reforestation, which is equally as dangerous, should be up there around what the logging is, maybe 18 or 20. But obviously, it's being underreported. There's just no way that it should be that low. And obviously, from the testimony here, a lot of contractors are not reporting accidents, either through intimidation, and I think even more so, it's the culture. My mom's Hispanic, so the culture is hardworking. Don't snitch, don't complain. That is the culture of these hardworking people. And so between that and the intimidation, these accidents go unreported. So I think the Workman's Comp Division and Oregon OSHA need to have a more proactive approach in that. Concerning the H-2B program, I am for the program. I used it once. It's very cumbersome, but there is absolutely no one looking out over the program. Back in 2009, 2010, when Mr. Obama passed the Stimulus Act, $20, $30 million hit Oregon in work, and most of that went to foreign workers. And before you can get on the H-2B program, and I was part of it once, you have to prove there is no American workers to do the job. I was getting 400 to 500 applicants a month during that time of people, Americans, out of work. And what these folks would do, the Oregon Employment Department is part of this system. These workers would go to Powell, Idaho, population 25, and put a job request for 200 employees. And there's only 25 people in the town. So what would happen? The Oregon Employment Department say okay, they would pass it on to the U.S. DOL, and they would get permission to bring in 100 workers. These same folks were undercutting me by 50% on my bids, and I couldn't understand how they could continue to hire H-2B workers when there was plenty of work here in the United States. So I guess to sum up my whole thing is, it takes a task force of the U.S. Forest Service, Oregon Department of Forestry, OSHA, BOLI, USDL, and anybody, any of the other regulatory people to come together and dig into this problem, these problems that arise. Because if you don't, my big pet peeve, and when I talk to the U.S. Forest Service or Oregon Department of Forestry, that is not my job. That is their job. That is their job. And pretty soon, it's what we hear today, these abuses. And it's because there needs to be not necessarily more regulation, because you know, I don't know any of the contractors in the industry that pay the Affordable Care Act. They'll circumvent the minimum wage. They'll circumvent sick leave. I guarantee you, most of the contractors didn't pay the sick leave in California where they're down there, even though they were obligated as of July 1st. So there has to be a joint task force. There has to be enforcement of these regulations. We don't need more. Probably the only regulation I would see needing added would be that of travel pay. Most of these workers travel 2 to 4 hours a day without being paid. Our firm, we pay minimum wage for travel pay, and after they travel for 2 hours to the job site, they work 8 hours and then travel two hours back home. Again, retaliation and or enforce their cultural pride in their job doesn't allow them to say anything, although there is no law on travel time. So with that, again, I thank you for giving me the opportunity. I'm very passionate about this, so thank you.
We can tell. Thank you very much, mm-hmm. Mr. Wheelock. Mr. Salgado, anything you want to add, having heard what Mr. Wheelock said?
Yes, you know, what I've heard is how the workers are treated in the work environment as far as working in under a U.S. Forest Service contract versus private. I, myself, work mostly private, and I know for all these years that I worked for private companies, they are really focus on safety and treating their employees right. I mean, they don't let you just go out there and just jump off a cliff or don't wear the right protective equipment when you apply in herbicides. I mean, they are on top of those things. So I wanted to add that to that, those comments. And as far as the H-2B programs, I know it's a good program. I'm just recently getting started on that program, but mm-hmm. I haven't experienced that, you know, just hiring people with that program. And
mm-hmm. yeah. so and do you have any recommendations to us about how to deal with the bad actors that are out there? You know, those companies that are underbidding through mistreatment.
Yeah, it's more enforcement, and just make sure that, you know, like they were saying, just don't announce that they're coming to do the inspections. You know, just do random inspections, because I'm pretty sure that the companies that are working for, they have an idea where the crews are working. So I mean, they don't need to necessarily contact the employers. You know, they can go directly to the companies that they're doing the work for. And that's a good way to get to that point.
Thank you. Any other comments? Okay, thank you both very much for your testimony.
Well, I want to thank you guys for letting us be here.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, next we have Brian Pugh, please, from the our own Oregon Department of Forestry. Okay. Brian, welcome.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, and committee members. For the record, I am Brian Pugh. I serve as the Deputy Chief of the State Forest for the Oregon Department of Forestry.
The State Forest Division manages approximately 820,000 acres of state-owned public forest, providing a collection of social, environmental, and economic benefits for Oregon. Part of the work consists of actively managing to ensure healthy forest lands that provide a sustainable and predictable flow of timber. Public contracting is used as a tool to conduct many of the reforestation and young stand management activities necessary to accomplish this work. Work performed by contractors on state forests include tree planting, herbicide application, and pre-commercial thinning. Accomplishment of this work is an important to achieve the desired outcomes of state forest. Each year, the department utilizes around 15 contracts, amounting to about $1.5 million of expenditures. The state's contracting process is utilized to perform these activities. Again, a majority of this work is with tree planting. Once a contract is awarded, the contractor is responsible to comply with all federal, state, and local laws, regulations, and ordinances applicable to this contract. Contractors provide personnel to work who are properly trained, licensed, and qualified for the work type, and shall have the minimal ability and experience required for this work. The department's contract administration focuses on technical aspects of the required contracting work details and always has an eye towards safety and all other contract requirements. Proper oversight, education, and enforcement by the appropriate regulatory agencies such as Oregon OSHA, Bureau of Labor and Industries, and the Oregon Employment Department are necessary. These agencies play an important role to ensure labor laws are enforced and workers' rights are protected. Oregon Department of Forestry has worked with these agencies and OSHA on issues and investigations. The department remains committed to this important information exchange and will continue to work cooperatively with these agencies as needs arise. This is an important workforce that really provides a lot of benefits to Oregon's forest and helps us have a strong, healthy forest industry, and the department is willing to work with other agencies for enforcement and help make sure the laws on the books are enforced and that proper education is disseminated to the contractors and to the workforce. I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about the Department of Forestry's Fire Protection Division. The Protection Division also utilizes this labor force contract for wildland firefighters. This contract service is an interagency agreement between the Department of Forestry, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Forest Service, the Washington Department of Natural Resources, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the National Park Service, providing approximately 180 20-person crews. That equates to about 3,600 firefighters available to work in Oregon and Washington and throughout the West. There are approximately 45 private companies that provide these crews, with many of them owned by women, minorities, veterans, and small business owners. During the 2015 fire season, there were 8,000 crew days spent on fires, primarily in Oregon and Washington. These contracts are, too, an integral part of the success of the complete and coordinated wildfire suppression system. In closing, I want to stress that these are necessary and beneficial labor services that assist in achieving the agency's mission of managing and promoting stewardship of Oregon's forest to enhance environmental, economic, and community stability. I want to thank the committee for your time and willing to entertain any questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian. Let me ask you a question. In terms of, so what is the department's responsibility to make sure that the contract requirements are being met in terms of safety, et cetera? Do you rely on your partner agency, the sister state agencies, or is there a responsibility for the department itself to do spot checks and things like that?
Chair Jumbo, that's an excellent question. I appreciate you asking, and I have it in my notes. I cut it out in the sake of brevity, but you know, safety is an important cultural issue for the department. We've heard earlier today that it's a hazardous industry. We have a strong safety culture at the department, and any safety issue that's identified in the forest environment, our folks are trained to immediately identify this and address it. So a safety concern when a crew is involved, if we are on site and we see a safety issue, the first thing we would do is to make contact with the crew foreman. The crew foremen are required by the contract to speak English and all languages of the crew, of the members of the crew. And so we would speak directly and ask that the safety concern be immediately addressed. Following up from that, when we get back from the fields, if it was a severe situation or we didn't think it was immediately addressed, we would contact for reporting purposes or OSHA and report that. And then we would work with OSHA on any kind of follow-up investigation, providing information exchange and anything else.
And how often does that happen, that there are issues that arise that, you know, require, you know, subsequent investigation, would you say?
To be clear, our administrators aren't on the work site at all times. And when I pulled those administrators to get ready for this testimony, it was a very rare event. And it does work both ways, where we see something and report it, and or when OSHA comes to us and asks us for information because they've got a lead or a tip from another source.
Senator.
Yes, Senator.
Kind of to tag on, looking at it from the wildfire side of things with these crews, most of the time before a crew is deployed to a fire, they're actually, whether it's an ODF inspector or a Forest Service inspector, that goes through and makes sure they have all their personal protection equipment, and also checks to make sure that the individuals have their training. We get these little ID cards when we accomplish our training. So that's usually done prior to every fire. So that's scrutinized pretty good in a fire scene.
Okay, thank you very much, Brian.
Thank you.
Okay, next, Scott Dahlman. We move over to the private side. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Scott Dahlman. I'm the Policy Director for Oregonians for Food and Shelter, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. Just as a reminder, Oregonians for Food and Shelter is a grassroots coalition. We're made up of farmers, foresters, and other pesticide users, and we work on issues involving pesticides, fertilizer, and biotechnology. I also wanted to mention that I am a member of the Governor's Environmental Justice Task Force as well, so I've been a part of those conversations there, but want to make it clear I'm not speaking on behalf of the task force today. So first and foremost, I want to express our sympathy for the concerns that were expressed today. We heard some stories that are very, very concerning about what may be going on out there, and we are very sympathetic to what's going on and believe that all employers should be held accountable for following the law and upholding the safety standards that we have out there. As you've heard from many of the speakers today, there is a robust regulatory system out there to help ensure workers' safety, but it does appear that there may be some gaps in enforcement and education around these right now. So the agencies need to enforce the law and prioritize these kinds of cases. I know we often hear that there are constraints to being able to do that, but the way we see it, that is an issue of prioritization, and these kinds of issues clearly need to be a priority from these agencies. We have seen recently some more efforts put towards some of the concerns that were mentioned today, specifically on wage theft with House Bill 1587 that was put forward by Chair Dembro earlier this year, and we're excited to hear an update from Boley today about how those efforts are going forward to get more enforcement on those issues. The agencies need to be held accountable for doing this, for upholding the law and ensuring that concerned workers do have an avenue to lodge their complaints when there are concerns and to reach out and do that. We also believe that the agency should work on educating employers on the requirements and to address these potential issues and to get ahead of them so that we're not just coming in after an incident has occurred, but that everybody knows what's going on ahead of time. So I'd like to talk a little bit about an example that I'm more familiar with in the pesticide arena, and that is the worker protection standards around pesticide use. And you heard some concerns around pesticide use, especially in forestry, from some of the earlier speakers. You should know that the worker protection standards were just updated by the EPA earlier this year. These were significant changes and one of the first major updates in almost 30 years, actually. They include new training, posting, and record-keeping requirements around pesticide use. And just as an example, one of the new requirements is that all employees that enter an area that's been treated within 30 days of the reentry interval. So with most products that are used in forestry, the reentry interval is 24 to 48 hours. So you're talking 31 to 32 days. Any worker that goes into that area has to be trained before they go into that area. They are working on updating the training materials, and those specifically will have information about even things like the concerns you heard earlier about how to launder clothing after you've been in those areas. Those will specifically be addressed in the training that every worker gets before they go into one of those areas.
Scott, that's pesticides?
Pesticides.
Herbicides, maybe.
So, just as an overview, thank you for bringing that up. Common misconception, right. Pesticides actually includes herbicides, insecticides, rodenticides, et cetera. Pesticides is the overarching, although that's oftentimes confused with insecticides. So right now, OFS is working with state agencies to implement the new rules. They are going into effect in 2017 to develop training materials and outreach to employers and to employees about what the new changes are, so that we're making sure with these new rules that we're getting that information out to everybody so that this training is occurring the way it should. We think this is a good example of training requirements that are attempting to get ahead of these issues before an incident, and we are hopeful that OROSHA will follow through with their promise of outreach to employers and employees on this issue. So in summary, the bottom line on this is that, as you've heard from many of the speakers, we believe that there are a robust set of regulations governing workplace safety, but there seem to be some gaps in enforcement that need to be addressed. Outreach to employers and workers is absolutely critical on these issues, and we stand ready to assist in those efforts. So with that, thank you again, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Scott. Any questions? Yes, Senator Thatcher.
At the very beginning of your testimony, you mentioned that you're a member of the Environmental Justice Task Force. When was the last meeting? And I ask this only as a proponent and stalwart, yay, cheerleader for the Transparency website. And so I'm just wondering when the last meeting was. Was it the September meeting? Or
Chair Denbrough, Senator Thatcher, I'm going off the top of my head,
that's
but
okay.
I believe it was March. I believe it was mid-March of this year. So
okay.
That was our first quarter meeting. I can't remember the exact date of it, but there has been a meeting this year.
Thank you. The reason I was asking is I was looking to see if there were any meetings this year, and I didn't see anything come up on the public records, the public meetings notification system on the Transparency website, which lists hundreds and hundreds of the public meetings that we have, and I didn't see that in there. They're supposed to be just given to DAS, and they post it. So just FYI, there you go.
Well, that's unfortunate. We should get those up there. The next meeting, I believe, is June 3rd coming up as well, so that'll be our second quarterly meeting.
Cool. It'd be awesome to see that on the site.
Yes. We'll be talking to the responsible people, I promise.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering, on this Environmental Justice Task Force, is that where there are people such as enforcement? Do they attend these meetings?
Yeah.
Or would this be a separate sort of work group that you would set up, you think, to in order to come up with solutions, ideas to fill in the gaps that you mentioned?
Chair Denbrough, Vice Chair Thatcher, I would say that the task force is set up actually to give recommendations to the governor, and it's regard to natural resource agencies. Mm-hmm. So we don't generally work with the agencies who have enforcement in this area. That being said, at the last meeting, the task force did invite in both OROSHA and Boley to come in and talk about their efforts around this thing. So there are attempts to try to coordinate with those agencies, but it's not directly a relationship of us giving recommendations for those agencies.
I see. And Mr. Chair, we're going to be hearing from them later, it sounds like. Okay, perfect.
Yeah. Okay, thanks a lot,
Thank
Scott.
You.
Very good. Okay, it's time for the agencies. Let's bring you all up here at the same time. Jim Booker, Gerhard Teubel, Amy Clare, and Michael Wood. So we have employment, we have Boley, and we have OSHA. Welcome, everyone. So tell us what's going on and what you could be doing even better.
Good morning, Chair Dembro, Vice Chair Thatcher, members of the committee. I'm Jim Booker. I'm the Oregon Employment Department Federal Programs Manager. I'd like to talk a little bit about the temporary worker program, H-2B, as it's known for non-agricultural workers. I agree that the program is complex. There's no doubt about it. It's designed to help ensure U.S. workers have jobs and at the same time provide for foreign workers when the need is there when you can't find them. Typically in the program, there is a large lead time when the applications of employers are sent in to both the Employment Department and the U.S. Department of Labor. Typically 90 to 75 days before the need, the start date, work date. So you can see that there's a long process that starts right there. After that, of course, Oregon Employment Department is responsible for looking over the applications to make sure it meets the requirements of the law. If there are any issues that need to be fixed, something that doesn't meet the requirements, we send that to the employer. They have an opportunity to fix it. Once it's all ready to go, it's sent to Department of Labor, where, again, the visas are worked out with the Immigration Department, and workers are brought in. Typically, our job after that is to do some outreach to the workers and to make sure they're aware of both their rights and safety issues. Our job is to go out, find the workers. When we find them, we're supposed to talk to them about the rights under the H-2B program, the complaint system and how that works. We also talk to them and check that the H-2B or H-2A contract assurances, the things that the employer said they were going to do, are happening. And so that's the first step there. When we talk about education and making sure that people are aware of what's going on, as we talk to the workers, we also bring information from other agencies like Oregon OSHA or Boley or some of the others to make sure that that information is out there. So safety information, we bring information about pesticides and how to work with them and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. We also educate employers. We started this past year doing seminars for employer where we invited agencies such as DOL Wage and Hour Division, Boley, or OSHA, others, to talk about what the requirements are of the law so employers are not unaware of what they need to do. Some of the things that I've been asked to answer, questions that were given to me before I came in, as far as the program itself, last year there was a change in the law as well as a very sharp increase in the number of folks overall in the country, 79% increase applying for H-2B visas. That caused quite a delay in getting those processed. U.S. Department of Labor has acknowledged that fact, and they're working on fixing that so it doesn't happen again next year.
And just to clarify,
yes, sir.
So those requests are coming from employers, right?
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, yes, that is correct. Those requests are coming from the employers. Also, in Oregon, we're beginning to see some increases that we think are going to go up dramatically in requests from employers. In 2014, we had 22 H-2B listings. In 2015, we had 31. And they're beginning to be quite a bit more diverse than they ever were. Where they were primarily reforestation workers in the past, we're now seeing carnival workers and landscapers and things like that. So I agree that the makeup of the workforce is changing, and possibly the number of workers. You heard from an employer just recently about some of the issues. The employer claims that there were quite a few workers there that he had to choose from. As part of what we do with the employers in this process is advertising must happen. The jobs need to be announced and gotten out there in as many possible ways as we can. The employers are required to contact former employees. They're required to contact current employees and let them know about the jobs. They're required to advertise in newspapers. We also share those announcements with folks like Legal Aid Services of Oregon and anywhere we can. Sometimes we have radio spots where we announce these. Typically, though, we are not getting a lot of response. We have very few people that we can refer. That doesn't mean they're not there. It just means we're not seeing them, so we're not able to make many referrals. Also, as far as the types of complaints we get against employers, you've heard the testimony of the workers. A lot of that jives with what we get. We have complaints about no water or dirty water, dirty restrooms, no restrooms, intimidation, sexual harassment, things like that. Our job is not a compliance one. However, we are required to report those things. We do work very closely with Oregon OSHA and with BOLI. We have a very good relationship. We have never had a issue where those complaints were not promptly handled. Another question I was asked is, has an employer been denied an H-2B application because of these complaints? Unless we have proven complaints, we can't deny services to folks. And so most of the complaints that come to us, like the restroom issues and things like that, employers fix right away. And so we wouldn't use that as an issue to stop them. And so in the time that I've been in the position, we have not denied an employer because of one of these issues, but I've also not had someone come to me and say, here is a proven serious issue that needs to be addressed. And so I believe that I've covered the areas that I was asked to cover. If there are any questions, I'm available. Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Gerhard Teubel. I'm the administrator of the Wage and Hour Division at the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this morning's discussion about wage enforcement and workplace safety for reforestation workers. As you may know, among its various responsibilities, the Wage and Hour Division of the Bureau of Labor and Industries issues licenses to farm labor contractors and forest labor contractors who recruit, solicit, supply, or employ workers for others in agriculture or in forestation or reforestation of lands. And I thought this morning that perhaps I would just very briefly describe how this licensing, these were licensing regulations came into being, why they came into being, and basically what they require for these labor contractors. The licensing requirement for farm labor contractors was enacted in the late 1950s by the Oregon legislature in response to concerns about the conditions in which farm labor contractors were working and living. It was believed that through licensing, the state might stem the abuses which were occurring in the fields and in the labor camps by more closely monitoring the activities of the contractors. By the mid-1970s, the licensing requirement was extended to forestation and reforestation contractors, where, much like agriculture before it, labor contracting was becoming a prominent feature. And in fact, many of those workers who were hired as farm laborers were transitioning into forest labor, or in fact were doing both types of work seasonally. in 1996 for much of the same reasons as adding reforestation as a licensable activity. Forest fire suppression was added as a kind of activity for which a contractor would need to acquire a farm labor contractor license. Under the existing regulations, a person who acts as a forest labor contractor must obtain a farm labor contractor's license for forestation and reforestation work. They must have this license before they engage in the contracting activity. Nearly 400 persons are licensed as farm labor contractors with the state of Oregon, of which about 250 possess an endorsement to perform forestry work or reforestation contracting activities. The requirements to obtain a labor contractor's license are relatively straightforward. As part of the licensing process, a contractor or an applicant must demonstrate that they have the financial ability to pay workers that they will be hiring. Most do this by providing the agency with a copy of a corporate surety bond. They put up a bond for the payment of wages in case that they're unable to meet their payroll or unable to pay one of their clients for some monetary amount that they may owe. The amount of the bond depends on the amount of workers that they hire. Contractors have to demonstrate that they have insurance on the vehicles that they use to transport workers. They have to demonstrate that workers' compensation insurance is in place and will be provided to each individual performing work. They have to demonstrate that they are compliant with state and federal tax laws, that they don't have outstanding tax debts. And they have to demonstrate that they have a knowledge of what the labor contracting and wage and hour regulations are. And they do this by successfully passing a test that the agency gives to each contractor before finally issuing the license. Once licensed, labor contractors are required to perform certain kinds of duties that are meant to protect workers from exploitative practices and are meant to shield the contractor's clients from dishonest practices. That would include promptly paying any wages or monetary amounts owed, complying with the terms of all legal agreements that they enter into, filing information with BOLI. For example, contractors are required to file certified payroll reports on the work that they do for the projects that they have been on, in which they'll report or identify the workers, how much they worked, what they were paid. At the time of hiring or recruiting workers, they're required to supply the worker with a written summary of what the terms and conditions of that employment are. They're required to furnish each worker at the time the worker is paid with a written statement itemizing the total amounts paid, the amount and purpose of any deductions, the hours worked, the rates of pay, and information regarding the work done if that work was performed under the Federal Service Contract Act, which applies to many of the federal contracts on the federal forests. Of course, as part of their license, contractors are also required to comply with any other kind of state or federal law that exists, which would include applicable field sanitation, housing and health safety, and housing requirements for putting up workers in housing that they provide. And the farm labor contractor regulations explicitly prohibit a contractor from retaliating against a worker for making a complaint for some kind of violation that has been happening during his employment. To be honest, and perhaps for reasons that we've already heard today, BOLI receives relatively few complaints or wage claims from reforestation workers. I would estimate that in the last few years, the Wage and Hour Division has conducted perhaps a dozen investigations relating to forest work. In the main, those would be complaints around wildfire fighting activities. We do work closely with the Oregon Department of Forestry, who regularly provides us with information, particularly around the firefighting contract that it administers. Boley has a single staff person to handle the licensing activities. In addition, we have currently 8 investigators for the entire state who are looking at complaints and wage claims that we receive. We hope to add 3 additional investigators soon to carry out the proactive types of investigation that the legislature earlier this year authorized for us to do. So that is in the works. I would say that, particularly in terms of the wage and hour enforcement in this area, there is an overlay between the state laws and federal laws. A lot of the forestry work is done, as we've heard earlier today, on federal lands by way of federal contracts, using workers who may have been brought in through a federal program. And so the USDOL has a large role to play in enforcing the wage and hour protections for workers who are working under federal contracts. Nevertheless, Boley does work cooperatively with USDOL, along with our other state agencies. Boley does participate in the federal labor-intensive contracting group. This was a group that was set up several years ago to take a closer look at federal contracts, forestry contracts. It includes the U.S. Department of Labor, the U.S. Forest Service, OSHA, Federal OSHA, State OSHA, as well as other agencies that do come together quarterly to talk about issues in reforestation. Most recently, we entered into a MOU. The various agencies entered into an MOU with the federal government. And the MOU basically sets out what the various responsibilities are for the different agencies. Boley's role in this group is primarily to enforce the farm labor contractor regulations, that is the licensing component that goes along with working as a farm labor contractor.
Let me just jump in to say that we'll post that memorandum of understanding on our website.
I think it's there now.
It's there.
Yes.
Great.
Boley and USDOL do cooperate in other ways to foster compliance as well. We've held joint trainings for farm labor contractors, for example. As I said, we participate in the U.S. Forest Service Farm Worker Partnership. We talk about issues around H-2B workers and try to coordinate our efforts as far as each agency playing the role that it can. Largely, in this case, Boley can provide information, copies of certified payroll reports, for example, to the USDOL to help it to enforce the federal laws that apply to the work that's being done on the federal contracts. As I mentioned, retaliation is expressly prohibited by the Farm Labor Contractor regulations. And at this point, I'd like to turn over the presentation to Amy Clare, who's the administrator of the Civil Rights Division and can talk more about retaliation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amy.
Good morning, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Amy Clare, and I'm the administrator of the Civil Rights Division at the Bureau of Labor and Industries. So we don't play a direct regulatory role like the Wage and Hour Division and other agencies in regulating the farm in this field, but we do enforce the anti-retaliation provisions. And I came away from listening to the testimony this morning that I firmly believe that I don't think a lot of folks realize what protections they do have. It's unlawful to discriminate against a worker for filing a worker's comp claim or even invoking the system. It's unlawful to retaliate against a worker that complains about workplace safety conditions. And my colleague Michael Wood, or my partner Michael Wood from OR OSHA, can talk more about our relationship with Oregon OSHA. We do get hundreds of complaints every year about people who are complaining about workplace safety, about other laws they think that might have been violated or regulations, but we don't have funding to do outright outreach in the field. And I would really love to explore with this committee and others opportunities that we can get out into the different workplaces and really talk about what laws. A lot of folks have talked. There are a lot of laws on the books. It's just the ability to get out and get people, make people aware of what we can do, which we can go out and try to resolve some of these matters. I mean, to file a retaliation claim with us, if it's an OSHA complaint about a workplace safety, they have 90 days from the last date of harm to file with BOLI. But there are a number of other whistleblower protections that we enforce. So if they don't make the 90 days, there's other whistleblower laws that may cover the circumstances that the person's concerned about. And they have a year from the last date of harm to file with us. So and maybe some of the anecdotes we heard about this morning, I gave my card out to some of the individuals in the audience, and hopefully we can redress some of those issues. I'd be happy to answer any questions about our processes in the Civil Rights Division.
Thank you, Amy. So you would agree with Mr. Dahlman that our statutes are fairly robust in this area, and the challenge is enforcement.
Yes, yes, Senator.
Okay. Mr. Wood.
Thank you, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, which we refer to as Oregon OSHA. And in that capacity, we are responsible for the workplace safety and health regulation, as well as education and outreach activities throughout the state, including in the activities that are described here. Obviously, the testimony you've already heard is very troubling. I've heard some of it before in meetings of the Environmental Justice Task Force, as well as in meetings directly with some of the advocates as recently as 2 weeks ago. And I think there are certainly some things that we need to tackle. I want to provide you a little bit of background information. I did share some data that's available on OLIS, but I'm not going to go through those charts in detail. I'll just touch on a couple of the high points and the additional information is there for you to look at. I would frame the last question you asked, Chair Dembro, slightly differently. I think what's clearly described is we have a compliance problem. And I think one of the things that we need to remember is that enforcement is certainly a tool, an important tool and a critical tool. Anybody who knows me knows that I don't downplay the importance of enforcement or enforcement role. But there also are educational opportunities, both opportunities to educate employers with regard to their responsibilities, but also opportunities to educate and reach out to workers so that they know that there are ways that they can take advantage of the protections they have, the ability they have to raise issues with us, the ability they have to raise issues with regard to discrimination or allegations of retaliation for activities under the law. With regard to the enforcement specifically in this context, we don't do a whole lot of enforcement in terms of raw numbers. In the data I provided, if you look, we do about 70 inspections per year in reforestation and in agriculture, labor, housing. Out of that, an average of about 18 are in reforestation. That's not an enormous presence, and I certainly wouldn't suggest it is. We actually do have a higher than average presence in this industry compared to all industries in Oregon. But it's lower than what you'd see in certain segments of the construction industry, certainly in traditional logging, in other things that we've identified as being particularly high hazard activities. So one of the commitments that we've already made to the Environmental Justice Task Force is to engage with them in a discussion about whether within the resources that we have overall, whether we should be apportioning those resources differently and whether we should be putting a greater priority on this activity. This also leads to a general concern about the level of resources and the level of workforce presence that we're able to maintain with our enforcement staff as well as with our on-site consultation folks. Because although we rely very heavily on our workforce presence, we actually have the highest workforce presence in the country when it comes to enforcement, which means that right now in the state of Oregon, by the most recent calculations, you are likely to be inspected on average once every 32 years. Now, that's six times more likely than in the state of California. It's more likely than any other state. But obviously, once every 32 years, a little, you know, right around a 3 1/3% enforcement presence is not a terribly high likelihood. And it contrasts unfavorably with what it has been over the years that have allowed us to build a fairly robust and successful program. If you look back to 1992, 1993, that number was once in every 15 years. If you look even just back to 2006, 2007, 2008, that number was once every 24 years. And so one of the things that we have faced is we continue to have, you know, if we grade on the curve compared to other states, we continue to have a high enforcement presence. But as we talk about deploying our resources in relation to any specific set of high hazard issues, including things like reforestation, we are, relative to the population we're involved with, we are deploying fewer resources. Some of that is in the fact that we actually do have fewer staff than we had a few years ago, but the biggest change is that the Oregon economy has grown, and there simply are more employers and more workers over the long term than there were when we originally started. Related to our high enforcement presence, and one of the specific questions I was asked to address is what our penalties look like in comparison to other states in the country. And if you rank all 50 states, we have the lowest average penalties for a first-time serious violation on average. We have always seen that as something of a trade-off in relation to the high enforcement presence, that if you think about deterrence, it's both the likelihood of inspection and the penalty that you receive when you're inspected. So we've seen that as a trade-off historically. It's actually 38% higher with an average penalty of $422 than it was in federal fiscal year 2010. At just over $300, but that still is the lowest in the country. Every once in a while, we're 49th. South Carolina sometimes slips into the lowest in the country. But
Michael, why is that? What determines the penalty level?
Well, we determine the penalty based on a variety of factors that we actually spell out in rule. We have the same statutory maximums that federal OSHA does and that most states do, the significant outlier being California, which has a significantly higher statutory maximum. We have the same maximums and we operate in the same general parameters. We focus on violations that are most likely to cause death. We focus our penalties on trying to motivate employers, which means that larger employers tend to get larger penalties, and smaller employers, which is a lot of the employment base in this state, smaller employers get smaller penalties. One of the things, in fact, that drives our overall average down is because our enforcement presence is higher, we actually inspect more of the small workforce, small employer workforce that makes up so much of our overall workforce, but that means on that individual inspection basis, those are going to be generating somewhat lower penalties. And frankly, it is a strategic calculation related, as I said, to the fact that we do have a high enforcement presence, and we have, you know, we have annual, at least, more likely quarterly discussions with the federal folks who monitor us over the fact that they have to look at the two things together and they can't just look at the penalties in isolation. I should mention that Congress increased the federal maximum in the Budget Act last year. So all states are going to be asked by federal OSHA to look at an 80% increase in the statutory maximum. Now, how that plays out in terms of specific penalties will be a question that we'll address again in our rulemaking that we do in response to whatever legislative action is taken next year on the maximum.
So, excuse me, just again, so that'll require legislative action to conform to the federal.
Yes, currently the maximum penalty that we can issue for a first-time serious violation, a first-time other than serious violation, is $7,000. That's set in statute. The maximum for a repeat, a willful, or a failure to abate is $70,000, and that's set in statute. The problems that we have, particularly with regard to our ability to enforce effectively with regard to this population, are not entirely unique to this group. One of the challenges we face is that we may decide that we want to inspect particular employers, but unlike fixed-site employers, we don't have an address that we can go to where we can do an inspection of their manufacturing plant. Obviously, that's a challenge we also face in relation to construction. We face it in relation to logging. We face it in other mobile areas. And when we do most of our scheduling based on actual identification of particular employers, that becomes a limitation and makes it difficult to get there. It also sometimes makes it difficult to get there without making the initial contact at the office, which is a work site, but is not the work site we actually want to inspect. We want to make the inspection on the remote site. And so one of the things that I think we need to do, again, in talking to the various folks, including the federal and state agencies who let these contracts, is we need to look at whether we can be more effective in getting to locations, perhaps by identifying projects in a different way rather than just using employers. We actually use a combination of approaches in construction. That has served us well. We may be able to use the same sort of a combination here. I guess the, what I would close with, and then leave you time for any questions that you may have, is that that clearly this is an area where our ability to enforce effectively and to drive compliance to some degree appears to not be working as well as we'd like. A robust set of regulations doesn't necessarily translate to a robust enforcement and compliance program. I think even within our resources, there are additional things we can do. I think we can build upon the partnerships that we've developed with the federal agencies and the other state agencies, and I think we can be more effective. But it's also something in the broad sense that we have to look at in terms of that issue of our declining enforcement presence overall, and we're going to be looking at those issues as well over the year to come.
Great. Thank you very much, Michael.
You.
Questions, colleagues? Yes, Vice Chair.
Yeah, Mike, you mentioned once every 32 years based on, I guess, the employer base that's in the state and how your resources match up with that. So how do you prioritize where you will go? Is it, do you focus on those more hazardous businesses? I mean, what? How do you prioritize your work?
Chair Demereau, Senator Thatcher, we prioritize, at our first cut, we prioritize by industry. So we have, in relation to certain high-hazard industries, construction, logging, we have particular targeting protocols that work in those industries and that focus more of our resources within those industries. Within fixed-site industries, including agriculture generally, we prioritize our enforcement activity by dividing the industries up into tiers based on a number of different risk factors. And then within each of those tiers, we do a random sample. So that foundries, for example, are much more likely to get inspected because they're in the top tier than a real estate office, which is in the lowest tier, and don't tell them, but they're very, very unlikely to get inspected by us in any given year. So all employers have the potential to be inspected by us in a programmed inspection, but it's weighted very much by the risk, and primarily by the risk of the industry. And the reason for that is that employer-specific data really isn't a great statistical indicator because, again, we're talking about small employers, so we found that it works better to target by industry. Within this industry, we actually still target employers using employer-specific data, and I think that's one of the things that we need to look at is whether we should change the way we're doing that targeting for some of the issues that were raised in the news article that you probably all read. I might also mention that our scheduled inspection activity, our programmed inspection activity, sort of what we do on our own motion, right now represents about 55% of our work overall. 45% of our inspections are responses to fatalities, accidents, hospitalizations, or in response to worker complaints or complaints filed by others. That's overall the distribution in this industry, I think, is likely to be a little different.
Thank you. Senator Rosenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael, or Mr. Wood, so it seems like one of the most disturbing things we heard earlier was this inspection is preceded by a call to the employer. Is there some reason why employers couldn't just be required to tell you where they're working in general without you having to reach out to them, and then you could randomly just show up?
Chair Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, having employers routinely give us that information would be a rulemaking. I think that it's something that we could do. It would involve a significant cost, and we'd have to assess it in that context. In this context, it may not be necessary, given the fact that the contracting entities may be willing to provide us that information. And so there's an opportunity there short of that. I'd also like to highlight the fact that one of the dynamics that plays out, as you got full further elaboration on that comment, is when we show up, folks know we're in the neighborhood. So we inspect one employer, and other employers rapidly hear about it. Again, that's not a problem unique here. We have that problem whenever we walk into an orchard. We have that problem when we walk into a construction site as part of a larger development. It didn't used to be as bad because people didn't used to have cell phones. We actually rarely will contact an employer to ask for their sites. And I think there are a number of things that we can do, and probably we can focus on this issue and explore a number of opportunities short of actually looking at requiring everybody in the industry to provide us the information, although I think that would be an option.
So just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so you do, there is sufficient statutory authority if you chose to use it. It sounds like, I guess I don't really get why voluntary compliance would be the way to go in a situation where the bad actors wouldn't be as likely to comply.
Chair Dembro and Senator Rosenbaum, I'm not absolutely certain about the statutory authority question. And when I look at the voluntary compliance, I'm thinking in terms, first of all, of the U.S. Forest Service, the Oregon Department of Forestry, and the private landowners. So it wouldn't be going to the contractors themselves and asking them to comply voluntarily. I'll explore the issue about the degree to which we can pursue that and whether it fits under our general grant of rulemaking authority.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Yeah, we appreciate that. Just two very quick questions. There were issues raised about workers in hospitals having translators that perhaps were not trustworthy. What we can do about that. Is that something you've heard about, any of you? And then the overtime question. Do workers in these industries, are they eligible for overtime here in Oregon? We heard they were in California. That's probably a Gerhard question. The other one may be an Amy question. I don't know.
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, unfortunately, I really don't have a good answer for the translators in the hospitals. I only know anecdotal. I don't know if there are laws that I can look into it. It's definitely not something we enforce, but it certainly seems reasonable that they would have people who can do translation services that aren't part of the employer's management team.
Thanks. And have you heard the overtime issue?
Chair Denbrough, I would say generally they would be entitled to overtime. There are exemptions, of course, there are exemptions for overtime. There are exemptions for farm labor workers from overtime. But in general, I would say a forest worker would probably be entitled to overtime. There are, if they are working under a federal contract, there may be overtime requirements which are stricter than the state standard. There may be, for example, daily overtime that's required or some other kind of overtime standard as well.
Thank you.
Senator Dimmer.
Yes, Senator Burke.
Just a comment on this, back to the H-2B stuff. I have a chart here. You know, when you get this H-2B contract, there's certain wages you have to pay. It's state by state, and even some states are even broke down into counties by county, and it gets complicated. And then there's also usually a health and welfare price. I think it's like $4.11 is what it is this year that you have to add on to that too. So, I mean, even that is scrutinized. You know, it's there. It's in place. Whether it's enforced or not, I can't. But just so the committee knows, there is a very good wage. And if you look at some of these wages, they're actually pretty good wages, you know, on the H2 that the employer has to pay. They're pretty good wages.
Okay, well, thank you all. Thank everyone who came forward today. I think we have a lot to chew on here. I've learned a lot. I think we probably all have. And is a problem we need to address, obviously. So thank you all. I will say that over the course of this hearing, I have received assurances that the Environmental Justice Task Force minutes and agendas will be posted promptly. So watch out for them. Okay, so with that, we are adjourned. With that, we are adjourned. Okay, so with